convene. Did I say adjourn?
Yeah, sure. Come out of here. Oh, oh, great, man.
You've ever run, Frank.
Well, I stand corrected. I was thinking about the good doctor from Medford and the punishment that he's going through and the need to adjourn reasonably with his drive home. Anyway, we will convene the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor Subcommittee on Health Care Reform. I might preface our testimony today with comments about what the objectives, what we believe the objectives to be. And that is that, as we have discussed with various persons, this whole issue of workforce preparedness to meet our needs in the healthcare sector, it appears that we may have gaps in the data that we rely on to make long-term, far-reaching policy decisions about healthcare issues in this state. So our goal is to get a sense of where we are today, the gap that we may have, and what we may be able to do to close that gap, to have good, reliable data upon which to make workforce policy decisions. So with that, we welcome the first panel today, Dr. Moorhead and Ms. Edlin, and would welcome your comments and what you can inform us today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for having us. For the record, my name is Tina Edlin. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Office for Health Policy and Research. I'm here today to, you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and then I can start?
Dr. John Moorhead. I'm an emergency physician in Portland at OHSU and a member of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. Thank you for having us.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say I ran into Mr. Berkovian the other day, and he admonished me to try and keep this funny and engaging. And I can guarantee you there are no jokes anywhere on the Internet about workforce issues, physician workforce issues, so I'll leave that to people who follow after me. What I was asked to cover today was what our office does in physician workforce issues. It's actually a very small part of what our office does, but we have done some work in this area and we run across some really very consistent issues. So I thought I could talk about that and then hand it off to Dr. Moorhead to talk about things in a broader sense. Measuring workforce is like, I actually stole this line from one of my office mates, it's like catching fish with your bare hands, because there's no net, there's no place that captures everybody at once. Every time we want to learn something about the workforce, we're wading in and doing sort of a piecemeal kind of approach. We're also confronted with the issue that all Oregonians, when we do get data, all Oregonians don't have equal access to providers, so we don't know that piece of it quite often. And then the information that's gathered, because we do it here and we do it there and we do it different times of the year and have different purposes to it, it's oftentimes not comparable. So it's not particularly helpful to a lot of the work we do sometimes. And then the point I'd really like to make is it's a quote from William Deming. He's a statistician who actually turned around production in Japan after World War II. And his mantra was, if you can't manage what you can't measure. And I think that really applies here, that we don't know anything about what the status is of the workforce with any certainty, and we can't really make any adjustments when we don't have good baseline data. So what do we know about physicians? And I'm going to talk particularly about physicians because that's the group that we do most work around in our office. We know exactly what's on this slide 3. We know how many physicians are licensed to practice in Oregon. We know their gender, we know their age, and we know their specialty. What we don't know is we don't know how many of those physicians are actually involved in direct patient care. There are many who have administrative jobs and have no direct patient care. There are many who have research jobs and have no direct patient care. There are some who are actually retired but keep an active license in case they want to actually see some patients once in a while. So we really don't have a good picture just from the Board of Medical Examiners list of who's actually out there providing care in the community. we don't know, for those that we do that are practicing direct patient care, we don't know how much of their time they're spending in direct patient care. So we don't know if they're spending a half a day a week or 40 hours a week or 60 hours a week in direct patient care. So it really hinders our ability to assess the capacity of the system to meet the needs in the system. We don't reliably know where they practice. We have found, we've run these surveys a few years now, and we find that oftentimes, even though the Board of Medical Examiners asks for a practice address and a home address, that oftentimes physicians put their home address in both places. They don't want, apparently don't want the license to be sent to the clinic and get lost, possibly. So we don't know absolutely for sure what the geographic distribution is of care. We also don't know if they practice in multiple practices. We don't know where that might be, if they do 50% time on, you know, in West Portland and 50% in East Portland, or 50% in Redmond and 50% in Bend. We don't know that from any of the data we currently have. We don't know how much of their time they spend in specialties versus a subspecialty. So again, it's hard to monitor what kind of access there is out there. We don't know if they're open or closed at any time to Medicare and Medicaid. This is a harder one, and probably would, under any circumstances, always require special studies, but it's something I know that the work we do, we're always really looking at very carefully. And we don't know how many providers we might be losing to retirement. That's actually one of the main questions on some of the surveys we do, is what their retirement plans are, so we can start to see, get some idea of flow. So some sources of data in Oregon is the Board of Medical Examiners list with the licensing list, with all the issues that I just talked about, in terms of how it doesn't really tell us how many physicians are actually involved in direct patient care. There is the American Medical Association master file. There's an Oregon section of that master file, but it's only done every 3 or 4 years. There's a huge lag time with that. And then the local Department of Human Services has a health planning unit that for health profession shortage areas, they actually do a survey every 2 years where they look at primary care physicians. So again, it's just a part of the total pie. It's not all of physicians. It's just the primary care. So what our office's involvement is, in 2004 and 2006, we partnered with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. They wanted to do some assessment of their provider networks and the OMA, the Oregon Medical Association, to actually go out and do a survey of physicians. We looked particularly for demographics, age, gender, race, ethnicity, their specialty mix, the geographic distribution, some practice characteristics, and whether they accept Medicaid, Medicare, and workers' compensation was also part of the goals of that survey. We also have partnered with the Division of Public Health and the Northwest Oregon Health Preparedness Organization to look at the community capacity for expanding to meet surge demands if you had some kind of a major public health event. We built these surveys around a pandemic flu event, but to see if we actually, how much could it stretch the system as it is right now if we had that kind of an event. So those are the two ways that we come at this in our office. So the next couple of slides, I didn't want to get into presenting the results of this work. I think you have the notebooks, reports on the Physician Workforce Survey up there. The point wasn't to give you the results of that work, but just to show you some of the things we can get if we have this data. Slide 8. We can look at trends over time with accepting Medicare as a payer. If you look at this, 57% of doctors had no limitations on Medicare in 2004. That had decreased to 54% in 2006. The number who were completely closed to Medicare changed from 13% to 23%, which is cause for real pause. We have the ability to look at this by region, so you can see, I mean, anecdotally, we always are hearing from communities that there's only 2 doctors in town who still accept Medicare, or only 3 doctors in town. But the advantage of this is it puts real evidence behind that anecdotal, what we hear anecdotally. The next one is acceptance transfer Medicaid. Medicaid has this anomaly in the data that we don't quite understand, where you actually have more people completely closed and more people completely open, so more clinics completely closed and open. So the middle is going away. It's sort of bifurcating that they're either staying open or they've closed completely. It's a huge number, though, that have closed completely to Medicaid, from 13% to 21% are completely closed to Medicaid.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes. Could you give those numbers again?
There were 13% closed to Medicaid in 2004 and 21% closed in 2006. I can't believe I don't have my glasses.
And then the I just want to follow up on that. Do you have any percentages on how many are completely open? And then we get a sense of that gap. Maybe it's in your presentation.
It is. It is right here. And this is the anomaly in Medicaid. Yeah, there are also 40.
What page?
Oh, nine. It's the same slide. Right.
Thank
it's
you.
The same slide. Nine. I'm sorry.
All right. I'm just catching up. I'm slow. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
I got it.
I think I understand what's going on here. I think I know why. So let me throw something out here and see if I can figure this out. The number of physicians not taking Medicaid at all, so that I'm not seeing Medicaid patients, has increased.
Mm-hmm.
The number who have restricted their practice has decreased.
Mm-hmm.
So some people open their practice up a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at this thing, you see that there's more with no limitation and surprisingly more with absolute limitations. And I would suggest this is a result of the managed care plans. Those who are in strong managed care plans where they've seen the reimbursement approach something to reasonable, not good, maybe they're breaking even now, maybe they're actually making a little bit, are probably opening up their practices. So we have some parts of the state where physicians have actually complained they're not getting their fair share of Medicaid patients.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds shocking, but it's true. That's where they're physician-owned, managed care plans, great access, and dealing with reimbursement in a more positive fashion. So I think that's where you're seeing that increase. And where those plans aren't in place, you're seeing physicians say, I don't want anymore. I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that's probably the trend we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
That would make sense from the data you have here.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
Okay, I'm guessing
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
It would be really nice to see in both these where primary care and specialty care falls out. I don't know if you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Another piece of information that I think factors into this discussion with Medicaid and Medicare is the payer mix that providers have. And I know in our region, which is the Lynn, Benton, Lincoln region, our payer mix is 43% Medicare and 10% Medicaid. So you've got over 50% of your payer mix coming from sectors that, you know, we're denying access.
Mm-hmm.
It's a major issue.
You're correct. In some parts of the state, that combination of Medicaid and Medicare probably approaches 60 to 65% with very little commercial and the rest and a lot of uninsured, so that the rural areas might be especially hard hit by this.
Senator Morris, over the 2 years that we've done this survey, we've seen a definite relationship between the decision to balance payer mix by if something happens in Medicare, they'll cut down on Medicaid or vice versa. So we definitely see that in the data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if we go to slide 10. Again, this is just to show you, we can also look at plans to retire by specialty. The particularly shocking one here is that 41% of the neurosurgeons in the state are planning to retire within the next 5 years. This is on we only had 30-some return. There's 32 return their surveys out of a total of 75 neurosurgeons practicing in direct patient care. But still, it's enough of a flag that you want to dig down into that data.
If I could interrupt, and this is the point that Alan's made so much. I mean, you look at the data and you look at the numbers and you go, oh, that's not good. What's even worse is the geographic distribution of these already thin numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the real tail of the tape.
Mm-hmm.
So excuse me, you're probably going to make that point, but...
No, thank you.
Neurosurgery is likewise... that's an alarming
mm-hmm.
figure.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a comment and a question. I'm not surprised by neurosurgery, nor am I surprised by OB or surgical subspecialties. These people are the ones hit the hardest by our need for tort reform. And when they are in a position that they can financially retire, they do so. And many of these men and women are in their 50s, and they just don't want to go on anymore with the fear of tort reform, or fear of tort, not reform, fear of tort in front of them. And as soon as they can get out, they get out. I would offer that we're probably not recruiting at 25% replacement over the next 2 to 5 years in these areas. Mm-hmm. The other question I have is a global one. Do we have any idea of the number of physicians coming into the system compared to those planning to retire in the next 2 to 5 years? We already know, at least we think we know, we have a shortage of physicians right now in the state, especially in primary care. But if you looked at the number of physicians we plan to have coming in the next 2 to 5 years, looking at these numbers, the overall figure must be between 12 and 15%. Are we expecting a 12 or 15% bump in physicians coming in the next 2 to 5 years? Do we have any indication we're going to have that number coming in?
Well, I guess I'd answer that in two ways. We recruit physicians in two ways. We train them and try to keep them in the state, or we recruit them from outside the state. One of the papers that I was going to reference was a supply analysis of all healthcare professionals that has been done through the Workforce Institute on our website. That's just the people that we know are coming out of training programs. It doesn't. There is some national data you may hear about a little bit later this afternoon from the AAMC that talks about how well you're able to retain those folks that get trained in your state, physicians specifically. But I think as important, when we look at the need for health care, about two-thirds of our health care workforce that we anticipate over the next 10 years is going to be due to replacement, not just new jobs. And it's a national marketplace. And so when people finish their training and look at where to practice, they look at the entire environment and how attractive it is. As you mentioned several of the factors. So we don't know the answer to that. I guess that's the short answer.
We don't know. It's okay.
Okay, slide 11. Again, just to show you the kinds of things we can see by the ability to collect this sort of data is we can also look at retirement plans by region of the state. We could see it just in the age of the physicians in Northwest Oregon that this is probably an issue, but 33% of the total physician workforce in Northwest Oregon is planning to retire in the next 5 years. So again, it gives us a red flag in that area of the state.
Just as a question, if I may interrupt you. Dr. Moorhead and I were discussing before the hearing comments that I had heard from physicians with respect to them communicating their plans, and I have been told that there's a reluctance to do that. Does that in any way bias this information? In fact, it's understated.
Senator Morris, I would agree. I think there's been some work done in California to actually track what physicians tell us their retirement plans are and what they actually do. And if my memory serves me, I probably need to go back and refer to this article and find it for you. But it's an underreporting, if I remember correctly.
Dr. Bates, you have any comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would think it's probably underreported. It's more a matter of when can I afford to get out, and as soon as they reach that level. We had a little bump in the stock market here a couple of years ago, and that actually affected this. I know anecdotally probably in our area 15 or 20 physicians who chose not to retire because of that, they've recovered. They're out now. They went in and retired 2 years later, 3 years later. So I think that you're probably right. It's economic factors. And once they get out, they don't come back in. You just can't do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then slide 12 is really just to show you for the public health department, the work we did on surge capacity. And again, it's just the kind of use this data can be put to. What we did, this one was done in Northwest Oregon, six counties in Northwest Oregon, and what we found was once if we had a surge of over 10% of the total visits in the state, so a pandemic flu that required a 10% increase, once you get the system could actually absorb that. that. There's enough flex and enough availability for that kind of a surge. You get beyond that and you start to have to look elsewhere for taking care of those folks, that there's just not enough capacity in the system. Most interestingly, what we also found was the capacity differences were, it was very different for people who are insured versus people who are uninsured, and depending on the safety net. The safety net capacity is much, much lower than this in terms of being able to handle a major public health event. So, again, it's just a point to the usefulness for being able to collect this kind of data, this kind of information. With to close, before I hand off to Dr. Moorhead here, I actually think we do a pretty good job in our office with what the data that we have available to us, but we're limited somewhat in the generalizability of these results because we don't know a whole lot about the overall pool of doctors because of the limitations I just talked about. So we're somewhat limited in that sense. This data is it's collected very irregularly. It's only when Medicaid might have some money and need to look at their doctor network. It's not part of their regularly required reporting. It just happens when money is available. So I think that's a real problem with our ability to track this information over time. I think probably that a lot of these data elements, I think special studies would always be required, but a lot of these data elements could be collected through the licensure that goes on through the BME. And then they would need support if whoever collects this data needs support, analytical support, data entry. It's not as simple as just collecting it. You actually have to enter it someplace and then analyze it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
A quick comment. I can think of two other areas you can go to get some good information, one of which you're probably reluctant to go to, but one you wouldn't. One is to talk to the Medicaid managed care plans. Since Kaiser is not a big active member of that, you might want to talk to Kaiser separately, but they can give you some pretty good numbers across the state of who's actually in practice and what their specialties would be. They know information. The second piece of information you could get, which is probably the most accurate and most up-to-date and will give you the most information, what you want to know, is probably not available to you, and you probably wouldn't ask for it, but I will tell you this. The large drug companies of the state keep very accurate records of every physician in the state, how many patients they're seeing, what their specialty is, and how many prescriptions they write. They consider that very proprietary. But if they would share that with you on a macro basis, it would probably be pretty good information. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure you want to ask them, and I'm not sure they can give it to you. Okay? But it might be interesting to see. Okay?
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could. I want to tail on Ellen or Senator Bates' astute observation. There may be a way, you know, for that information to be, you know, sanitized, if you will, where they didn't feel they were putting themselves at risk or exposing any proprietary information, yet still may be enough in the aggregate useful data for you. Mm-hmm. So I would not discourage you from somehow asking. I would encourage you to ask. And then the second thing, just a general comment, Mr. Chair, and this is, you know, for Tina and Janine Smith and everyone over at Uper. I mean, you know, for as long as any of us can remember behind this diet, you guys have done more with less, I think, than any other department and agency, and your esprit de corps and your can-do attitude. Just thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Moorhead.
Thank you, Senator Morse. As I said, I'm here representing the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, and you have a packet of information. I wanted to just remind you that you created us, and we're trying to do the job that you set us up to do. OHWI was created in 2005, basically in recognition of what we've been talking about, the critical shortage of healthcare workers in an environment that anticipated expanding need because of the aging of the population and, in fact, the aging of the healthcare workforce. The Institute obviously focused much more broadly than physicians, but I think the comments regarding data and the need for data applies to all healthcare workforce. And I think one of the advantages to the Institute is it brings all healthcare workforce representatives, private, public, together in a way that the different workers, boards, agencies can learn from each other. And in fact, I think we're going to take an example from the state and take of one board in the state and take an example of what's been done in other states to make some recommendations to you on how we think we can close this gap in the data that, of course, is so essential and acknowledged to be a part of the access to healthcare reform business. We know that even if we focus so much on financing, we know that if we solve the financing issue, we still wouldn't have the healthcare workforce to be able to meet the anticipated needs of the public in the state. In fact, Oregon Employment Department projections, we look over the next 10 years, indicates that healthcare occupations top the list, at the list of the fastest growing within the state. And the number I used previously, about two-thirds of the projected jobs over the next until 2016 are due to replacing retired workers, not just new jobs. So we've got quite a work in front of us. The OHWI was established in 2005 to try and provide you with as good information we can regarding shortage, to try and recommend some policies and address the challenges and try to be a communication vehicle to both stakeholders as well as the public. The Institute was incorporated in 2005 as a 501c3. Our mission statement, you have it there, it's to advance the development of high-quality healthcare workforce to improve the health of every Oregonian. The Workforce Institute has I believe, a very distinguished board. We have an advisory council that represents the education, the private and public agencies. We have a dedicated staff. I'm pleased to tell you that last week we hired a new executive director, Joe Iskrig, who will join us in January, moving down from Olympia to accept the executive director job. The Institute has published two reports focusing in March of this year, partnerships and investments in Oregon's healthcare workforce, showing how public-private collaboration can affect workforce initiatives within the state. It's published on our website. The second one also speaks to the supply side. The title of the paper is Students Completing Healthcare Workforce Studies in Oregon, which gives us an idea about the supply side of healthcare workforce within the state. We hope we've provided some information that's been useful to you. You did draft and pass a Joint Resolution 24, you'll remember, which basically declared that we have a workforce crisis. And also Senate Bill 4, which established the Oregon Center for Nursing and the OHWI in advisory roles to the state boards of education and the Workforce Investment Board to address Oregon's healthcare workforce challenges. So we're trying to provide you the data with which you can make policy decisions, but I think the gaps in the data that we've talked about for physicians exist for almost all of the workforce in healthcare within the state. We have some pending studies, but I think I'll actually jump to a proposal, and maybe I can hand this to you, that actually builds on a model that we think is successful, and the model is in nursing within the state of Oregon, and we think we can build on that.
John, if I can just ask before we get this, does this, I don't want to say starts to blur the lines, some of these bright lines of the scope of practice, but does this get at generally, you know, a broader definition of functions that nurses can perform, various stratas of nurses?
This particular proposal does not. This particular proposal recognizes the fact that we don't know how many physicians are practicing in the state. We don't know how much they're working. We don't know how many patients they're seeing. I think that's the whole sort of background of this, is we don't have accurate data. We try to do these surveys. We look at every source we can, and we understand that it's inadequate. And if we're trying to make decisions, policy decisions, that we think will impact the access issue within the 12, 15 years, We clearly need data, and I think our proposal really gets to the point that we need some accurate data.
So this is trying to define the problem, not...
It's still trying to define the problem. We need the data to be able to make some policy recommendations, and as yet we don't have the accurate data. The State Board of Nursing and OCN have done a good job of collecting nursing data, and they do that through the licensure and relicensure process. And we believe that to get the data about geographic the issues we've been talking about, distribution, intent to retire, how much people are practicing, we need data that's going to give us essentially 100% compliance across workforce. The only way that's been able to be done within the state is through nursing, and as we look at other states, in particular North Carolina and New York, they've been able to do that through their relicensure process. They survey healthcare workforce when and where they get relicensed. They collect survey data. They get essentially 100% compliance. There is an issue, as Senator Moore said, about workforce, not just physicians. I think many of the workforce in being a little bit hesitant to be forthright with this data because they don't know how it's going to be used and they don't know whether it will be de-identifiable. Our proposal here is to get everyone in the same room, all the boards, everyone who participates in gathering data, and try to see if there's one way to do it that will work for the entire workforce, not just physicians, nurses, techs, whomever. And perhaps a way to do this is to collect this through the licensure process, de-identify the data, and then perhaps send it. And maybe that's one role that the Workforce Institute can play, is collecting this data that's de-identified, having accurate data, and then being able to come to you, present that data, and perhaps make some recommendations. We think this would apply to the educational institutions, the production of our workforce, retention we've already talked about, and, of course, I believe reentry is an issue, Senator Bates. I mean, certainly people do leave the workforce, but there is a reentry. We've got a model program at OHSU that's received national recognition. But again, if we don't have accurate data, how do we know what kind of recommendations to make about these programs? So I think we've kind of laid it out here. We really think that there's a broad array of folks that we could put together that hopefully could share across specialty, across workforce, across occupation, come up with hopefully a standard way of collecting this data through the licensure process, de-identify the data, and then be able to give you some accurate numbers. It's still identifying the problem. I don't think anyone disagrees that we have a problem, and it's going to be with us for quite some time. So let's take a step back and get accurate data from which we can make some recommendations. Those are our thoughts. This is a working draft. Our board is meeting next week to further discuss what we've presented this afternoon. But we're prepared to move ahead with that. We've got, a terrific board, great staff, and see that this is a potential role that hopefully you envision for the Institute and hopefully that we can play down the line. Thank you.
Knowing that the information we have to build on what we're trying to measure may not be complete or completely accurate, I would guess one of the things you did get back from the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners or whatever it's called now, but not the examiners anymore. Get their name out. Anyway, most physicians practice probably about 30 years. By the time they actually get their license and finish their training, they're probably a 30-year cycle for most of them, I would say, is a round number. Mm-hmm. And looking at the information you're giving us here, 50% of the age, 50% of the physicians in this state are in their last 10 years. Mm-hmm. This is an aging, if I'm reading this correctly, and the information is even close to correct, 50% of the physicians, male and female, are in their last 10 years of practice. Mm-hmm. We're going to potentially use half the workforce, 6,000 or 7,000 being the workforce, in the next 10 years is the potential we're looking at. So we're an aging group. Am I reading this correctly?
Yes, you are, Senator.
That's mm-hmm. a little scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, and as we've discussed, that not only is that number probably close to accurate, but the if we start to measure this through our new graduates, I think we're going to receive some surprising information about the workload and the number of hours that they're willing to put in when we compare it to these physicians who are near retirement age. And we make estimates, and we think we understand it, but unless we start to collect this data in an accurate way, we're not going to get a hold of it.
Well, I sense from the physicians that I interface with, the old guard, they have a different work ethic, and that's what I think you're referring to, than the new physicians coming in. Some of the new physicians don't want to work 24/7, be on call, the call issues particularly. You might expand a bit on that.
Well, I think it's true, and I don't think it's just physicians. I think it's really a cultural change that we're seeing not only here in Oregon but across the country, and that there's a different environment. There's a different orientation. It's not right or wrong. I don't think we need to make judgments about it, but we need to understand it, and we need that data to be able to project out 10 or 12 years about where we're going to be. But clearly, not only anecdotal data that we all receive from participating in training programs and talking to young physicians, there is a different culture. It's very different. It is a culture that rewards a balance in lifestyle, and we see that has been applied to training programs, whether it's physicians or nurses, and as it gets applied there, when these practitioners go out into the environment, they take the same kind of an orientation to their full-time job, their career. And so I think if we try to take what's been placed in regulations in terms of our training environment, it would be natural to expect that same kind of an environment would be found with practitioners. And I mean, we look nationally. I go to a AAMC healthcare workforce research meeting every year. We're seeing this around the world. You know, our workforce, our work, talk to the dean later, we have an 80-hour requirement in our training programs. In Europe, it's 56 hours. We think that's probably going to happen. The number in this country is going to go down, not up. And as that number gets down and that becomes the culture in which our workforce trains, it is only natural to see that will be extended into their careers.
Yeah, my understanding, you understand what the 80-hour thing is? That's the hours worked per week, I assume.
Correct.
And an 80-hour work week for a resident now is a decrease from when, you know, the old dinosaurs like he and I went through this thing. And it's probably better. Okay? It's probably better. And physicians, when I graduated, were willing and thought they would be working 67, sometimes 80-hour weeks. That was a normal work week, 12 to 14 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week, plus on-call. And the new concept is that you don't do that. You'll have healthier physicians, you'll have healthier patients, and it's a huge shift in the workforce, though, because the work that was being done during that time now has to be done by more hands. And so you need more physicians from that point of view. The population is aging out. And for lots of reasons, we're not recruiting in Oregon like we should. And we'll be discussing that, obviously, later on today, too. But there are some trends here that we have to pay attention to. And they're hard to measure.
Yeah, another issue, and this, is again, is not a negative or positive. It's just an observation that as we recruit more women into medicine, that when they enter that childbearing period, and I observe it in my community, they then shift back to part-time, or they stop out for a period. So factoring that in, as that shift goes to more women in the workforce, it declines the number of hours available for providing service.
I would just add, Senator, just anecdotal experience. You understand your community, and I understand a little bit about mine, and as a physician I understand a little bit, but we need the data.
Yeah.
And in other states they've been able to get this, and they've now been in North Carolina and New York been able to do this for 2-3 years and are starting to be able to trend it. That's what we need. Hopefully we can provide some data on which we can make policy decisions. It's inadequate at this point, and we end up making recommendations based on our own anecdotal experience, which hopefully we can improve on.
Right. Senator Wilson.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. I know you're trying to keep us on schedule, but John, did I I must have misheard this, but I thought I heard you say, we don't know how many physicians are in this state.
That's accurate.
That is an accurate statement?
Yep.
And we're having trouble getting that number?
That's correct. The best number we get is through the Board of Medical Examiners.
All right, that makes perfect sense.
Number of licenses.
Kathleen, hi. How many docs we got? Thank you. That's what.
And the answer is, we will tell you how many physicians have a license and how many are active and how many are inactive, and that's the number you get. But you have no other detail. Physicians get to near the end of their career and keep their license so they can, I mean, these are anecdotal.
No, okay, this makes
sense. So they can write a prescription for somebody.
Right.
And they write one or two prescriptions a year. People, it's not just physicians. We're all kind of reluctant to give up our license, even when we get close to the end of our careers. And we don't know how extensive that is. So we can give you some gross. Those are the kinds of numbers we get out of the survey from the board, but that's not the kind of complete data, hopefully, that we'd want to make policy recommendations on.
Well, let me just be as helpful as I can here. I can tell you where two physicians are in Oregon right now. One of them is working, and one of them is not.
He's got a bad tick.
Chair, one last question, please.
Yes.
I would guess the states that have started to get good information have made it a requirement of licensure that a survey be filled out. Ours, I believe, if my memory is correct, is voluntary. And it's a two or three page form that I fill out every couple of years. And would you think that making licensure the state of Oregon require the completion of a survey to be a value and the way of getting to this?
I think we may be getting there. The experience is interesting. I was talking to Senator Morse before the meeting in New York. They just started to do it. They just started sending out the survey, and they got agreement from the board there to just include it in the same envelope. There was nothing ever suggested, passed, or communicated that it was a requirement. But interestingly, they got 100% compliance from the first year.
Okay.
I think in North Carolina, it is a requirement. I think that's why we need to learn. You're going to hear from the nursing board this afternoon. They've been very successful. We need to learn from the other boards, get us all together, and figure out whether to make it what recommendations to make that can be helpful.
Thank you. My question would be, what is your timeline, and when could we expect to have essentially recommendations back to us? If you can do it by administrative rule, that's probably the best and most efficient. But if it needs the weight of statute, when might we see a recommendation?
I think there's a general recognition that this needs to happen across the healthcare workforce, and I think it's a matter of individuals. I do believe that one of the issues is no one has felt that it's their responsibility to do this. I think we can overcome that. But the other issue is no resources have been allocated to do this, and that is an issue. Whether it's to do the surveys or to collect and analyze the data, as we've talked about, there's going to be some resources necessary, and I don't know the best way to do that. But I believe that the organizations, certainly the Healthcare Workforce Institute, is ready to do this as soon as we can get people together. We'd like to see people in a room in January kind of thing and get to work on this. And hopefully, based on the experience of other states, that would put us in line to make some recommendations about what resources it will take and then move ahead. But I don't think it's I think this could happen fairly rapidly if we're able to act on this.
So we might expect a place on the agenda at some future meeting that we could then evaluate the steps that we might take as a committee to implement, get the ball rolling.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Any other comments? I think I speak for the consensus of the committee that this is something we feel is very important to address. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, Christine Campbell, Dr. Campbell, and Karen Burke, data collection in the field of nursing. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you for the invitation. Chairman Morris, I think I will introduce Louise Martell from the Oregon State Board of Nursing, who is here for Karen Burke, and let her start with the data collection first, because the Oregon Center for Nursing collects data that the State Board of Nursing does not. So she can lay the foundation for information that's collected, and then I'll fill in what we do. So.
Oh, thank you. Mrs. Burke is not able to be here today because she lives in Astoria. Okay. Mrs. Burke and I share a position. We are both education consultants with the State Board of Nursing. As was alluded to before, the Oregon State Board of Nursing has the largest database on the nursing workforce here in the state. We do obtain data through the licensure and renewal process for registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, as well as certificate renewals for certified nursing assistants and certified medication aides. We also collect data for work settings and practice areas as well. As was pointed out before, we would love to collect more data if we could, such as retirement plans and so forth, part-time, full-time, what role the nurse plays and so forth. The board also collects data for specialized groups within the state board jurisdiction, such as nurse practitioners and education programs. As you all know, the mission of the Board of Nursing is to protect the public, and we feel that the database does help this. The public has access to information about an applicant's licensure, which is open to employers or the public. The basic data that comes up when you check verification of license is dates of application, renewals, expirations, type and status of license, and any restrictions. The board does publish its statistics every biennium. We currently, the biennium for 2004-2006 is in preparation, but I did bring you a copy of the last biennium that we have statistics for, just so you have an idea what we collect and what we report about. The current data, if you need more current data about the nursing workforce and what we have in our database, the person to contact is Barbara Holtry, our public information officer. She is more than welcoming of people requesting data if they have a valid need for it. An example of readily available data that was alluded to last time is we know how many nurses we have practicing and how many nurses we have licensed in this state. As you can see in Table 1, we currently hold licenses and certificates for 69,116 individuals. At this point, we would like to have more data about employment. We're going to get at this, hopefully, through surveying employers about how many licensees they have working for them, whether the licensees are full-time, part-time, and so forth. But this is going to take a couple more years to get implemented. Currently, the most frequent requests come from recruiters and researchers for data. And, you know, they want such things as the number of licenses by type or by county. You probably know that there's a real dearth, there's a real need for nurses in more rural counties of Oregon. And those come through our statistics quite nicely. The Oregon State Board of Nursing cooperates with other organizations concerned about the nursing workforce, such as the Oregon Center for Nursing. Chris and I are quite often in communication about, do you have these data, do you have this data, can we have it? Great, what are you going to do with it? I am most intimately associated with data for educational programs. By rule, educational programs have to submit an annual survey on a form provided by the board. And because we are developing the survey instrument, we have the freedom to ask such things as faculty retirement plans. These data, we find, are very important for planning, for workforce planning. The board, we're currently compiling the data for the academic year 2006 to 2007. And an example of how we can use this data to benefit the workforce in the state is looking at some faculty information that I pulled out last night on age pending retirements and vacant positions. And this can be used to document the faculty shortage that may continue for years. Table 2 shows the average age of faculty here in the state. It goes from 42 to 53 years of age, but the high to low range is 24 to 75. Yes, indeed, we have licensees who are up in their 80s. The plans for retirement in 2 years are 27, and in 5 years is 29. These seem like fairly small numbers, but when you consider that Oregon has about 450 faculty positions, 450 faculty members, the loss of 56 represents over 10%. And this may interfere with possible increase enrollments in Oregon schools of nursing. In summary, the Oregon State Board of Nursing has a very large database related to nursing workforce. We also have subsets of data, such as the annual surveys of education programs. We welcome organizations committed to health care reform to use our data if you're a legitimate user. As I said, requests can be made through Barbara Holtry, our information officer. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
We were just kibitzing over some of your data, and it's very good
report.
Mm-hmm. And the, I'm from Deschutes County, and Alan, Senator Bates, is from Jackson.
Okay.
And we're just we are on page 12 of your report.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And we're noticing that Deschutes functionally has 2,000 nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackson, that is not that much larger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure Jackson is larger now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Jackson has 50% more nurses.
Hmm.
And it's going, is that because you're doing a better job in terms of, Jackson is doing a better job in terms of utilization, or you have that much more access to care? They're both regional.
They're regional centers, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the numbers would belie. Mm-hmm. Population is greater than just the county themselves because...
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the sort of thing that, you know, we hope that the data like this do provoke questions. Why is this happening here but not here?
Yeah.
That's all I can say about it, how this could be used at that time. I don't have a ready explanation for the discrepancy.
Well, and it mm-hmm. could be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of our, one of the paths out of this healthcare,
mm-hmm.
Morass is a greater utilization of the tremendous skills, talents, dedication, and commitment of nurses as opposed mm-hmm. to just the traditional physician thing. So, maybe Jackson County is further along that path than Bend, and if so, or mm-hmm. Bend, Deschutes mm-hmm. County, maybe there's some lessons we can learn from Jackson County.
Mm-hmm.
I feel embarrassed that I just admitted that on a public record.
Well, Southern Oregon does have
it's still come to the realization of some,
Yeah, Southern Oregon, from my perspective, has more have more schools of nursing or programs of nursing than the Deschutes area.
Yeah, and we're just getting those going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, because Central Oregon, the only program of nursing is Central Oregon Community College. Where farther south there's a program at Cave Falls through OHSU. There's one in Ashland, OHSU. We also have Grants Pass and Roseburg. So.
And Rogue.
And Rogue.
And Rogue Community
and,
College.
Grants Pass,
The Grants Pass program is that. Let me kind of drill down this a little bit deeper, too.
Mm-hmm.
Nurse practitioners are one of the areas we're looking forward to seeing a real impact in primary care, especially.
Mm-hmm.
And Deschutes County, as of these figures, has 66. Jackson County, 116, almost double.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not an answer from nursing programs.
No.
There's no good nurse practitioner program in any of these counties of significance. The OHSU has an outreach there. Mm-hmm. They do some. but there's a huge difference here, too. It'd be really great to see these kind of figures per population served. That'd be really an interesting thing to look at, to see the maldistribution probably in the rural versus versus other parts of the state.
Yeah.
If it does exist, I'm thinking it probably does.
Well, and that's really where I was going with this, is these numbers are great and they pose the question, and you know, but the next set of data we need, okay, what's the population served, you know, or nurse per capita, or you know, some yardstick we could, you know, compare apples to apples to, and then try to learn some lessons from that.
Yeah, well, that's another thing too, that you know, groups like OCN will pick up on that, you know, delve deeper into the data than we have, you know, personnel available through the Board of Nursing to do. You know, that's because of our mission is basically public safety.
Mr. Chair, another question. The other issue I'd like to see, that's not here yet, in about 01, 02, and 03, we made a concentrated effort at the legislative level and at your level, OHSUN and community colleges, to dramatically increase the number of graduates. A real push went on and still is going on.
Yeah.
And the response from the nursing community was really, really outstanding.
Thank you.
Yeah. But the last figures we got are 04, and I'd like to see 05, 06, and now maybe even 07 figures to see, have we impacted that? Are we still losing more people from retirement and going into other fields? People just leaving that nursing because it's a tough deal for a lot of people to get into and stay in? Or are we starting to see more nurses out there and the overall population curve shifting to a lower level? I mean, it's, the nursing population, like the physician population, is very aged out.
Right.
And we were losing people at a dramatic number compared to what we're putting into the system. And we'd like to see those figures and see if we impacted it. Have we actually made a change yet?
Yes, Senator Bates, we have. Since the 2006 data.
Identify your.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Please.
I'm Chris Campbell from the Oregon Center for Nursing.
Thank you.
The 2006 data indicate that we have increased the number of graduates statewide, community colleges, private schools, and OHSU. We're graduating 80% more, about 80% more, 76%, 80%, depending on which of the numbers you look at, graduates since 2001. Sustaining that program expansion, because a lot of it is on partnerships from community partners. The healthcare systems are providing a lot of support for faculty. They're lending their master's and doctorally prepared clinicians. But we have made a significant impact. I don't think actually any other state in the nation has had a statewide expansion of nursing programs like Oregon has. Some schools have done it, some regions have done it, but I believe we're the only state to have a statewide expansion.
I think the follow-up question.
Is it enough? I have the same one.
Yeah.
I want to know, is that surge, I hate to use that word these days, is that increased number of students being trained, is that translating into a larger workforce? I mean, the other side of this is,
right,
how many are we losing from age retirement? How many are just leaving the profession because it's just a really grueling, tough thing to get into and stay in? I want to know what's actually happened to the workforce. Has it gotten younger, and has it gotten larger?
Senator Bates, we are looking at that now. We are in the process right now, the Oregon Center for Nursing, of updating our registered nurse workforce and also our licensed practical nurse workforce.
Yes.
So we are updating that now to see what the numbers are. We do know that over half of the nurses in Oregon from our last report in 2005, which is in your packet, it looks like this. Are over 50, so they're starting to retire already, and we know that the average age of retirement is around 62. That's what we got from this last study that we did. And even though we are increasing the number of graduates significantly, we also get more nurses into the state by licensure from other states than we produce. So recruitment is still a huge factor. And even with all of that, we still have a projected shortage of having registered nurses. So we're focusing a lot on retaining nurses. What can we do to alter the workforce, the workplace, so and work patterns so that nurses can work longer rather than working 12-hour shifts. There's a lot of and how can we use experienced nurses to help mentor all of those new nurses? There's an awful lot of new nurses that we're producing. So those are some of the initiatives that we are looking at to build the workforce, make Oregon a place that nurses want to come to work, and then keep the workforce that we have for as long as we can.
Yeah, your own place.
But we won't meet right now that. What we're producing isn't going to get us where we need to be in by 2025. We still have to step it up a little and change our education so that we can get them out a little faster. Not faster as in fewer years to get through the program, but our baccalaureate students are in the programs for 4, 5, 6 years, and our associate degree nurses are taking 3.5 to 4 years. What we're trying to do is the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, for example, is a 4-year total baccalaureate program, part of which is done at the community college, and the BSN is also completed at the community college, so we can get that workforce out in a timely manner. That's another piece of building that workforce more quickly.
Do you have the database and the methodology to understand what is, you know, currently in supply and in stream, and what the demand is and where that gap might be?
We have the Chairman Morris, yes, we do.
So
we have some of that information.
Okay.
We use, actually, in the maroon packet that you have, are some examples. I gave you copies of some of the surveys that we sent out for employers, and we are also doing a faculty survey because part of the program expansion is dependent on having faculty, so our faculty shortage is one of our most acute in this state. Actually, it's a national issue. So we do look at vacancy, turnover, part-time, full-time status, what will it take to get you to increase your participation in the workforce, so you can see a little bit of some of the data that we have around those questions that you just asked.
And the programs that we've beefed up, in fact, started new, Western Oregon University, and increased funding at OIT, we're still short, is what you're saying.
Yes. Well, the demand is so great. And the nursing workforce is older. So we're over half of the nurses in Oregon. We're on average, the average nurse in Oregon is older than the average nurse nationally. We're just a little older state. So, but it's as Dr. Moorhead spoke of earlier, the whole healthcare. All of the workforce really is older. And as in healthcare, it's exacerbated because of the need for additional healthcare for the aging population. So that just healthcare is growing in the state, and the workforce is aging. So how we can alter that dynamic, and some of it will be through innovative ways of delivering care. We won't always be doing things the same way that we do it, that we deliver care now, different care delivery models. I think several of the hospital systems are looking at ways of using their nurses more efficiently. And there is a national, huge national effort on efficiency through the Institute of Medicine and Transforming Care at the Bedside, which is a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation initiative, and how to deliver care more efficiently and therefore utilizing the nursing and all of the healthcare workforce actually more efficiently to get better outcomes for patients. So it's a, we can't look at healthcare reform without looking at the healthcare workforce, because they, if we increase access, who's going to provide that care? People are looking at different ways of delivering that care as well. And there was a question earlier about
also mention pieces. specific numbers.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Brian.
All right. Would you, Brian, would like to join?
Yeah, go ahead. Fair enough. I have some of the data that you were requesting in the testimony. So, anyway, go ahead. I lost my train of thought.
I was just pointing out that Chris actually has a lot of this data in her packet, in her testimony, as far as numbers and the level of shortage. Mm-hmm. And I was pointing out to her in specific pages where the numbers actually are that I think you're actually requesting, Senator Morris. In her testimony, I think it's page...
It's page 3,
bottom of
which
page
I did
three.
Write.
So a lot of the questions that are coming to her are things that she had in her written testimony.
Okay.
And you may want to actually pull out and be able to follow the numbers.
And I was really actually going to...
The question started coming, I think, before she started presenting the data that she was planning on getting to.
We're good at getting things out.
That would be in the written testimony. It should be on the front, in the front of the packet, on the right-hand side. Oh, on the left-hand side is a copy of the report.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What are you referencing here?
About this page here.
Yeah. That one is from the from Dr. Martel. Mine looks very similar to it.
There it is.
And it was in the maroon packet on the right-hand side.
Yeah, there's page 3.
Did you say earlier that some of the data you're collecting is like, I guess, satisfaction or what nurses are telling you they want or need to stay in the workforce, or are you collecting more just numerical?
We're collecting
kind of
both. We're collecting both of that info. What are actually? We can look specifically at the questions. Oh, I didn't bring. I brought the employer survey, and I brought the faculty survey. The employer survey is when we're looking at the demand for nurses, turnover rate, vacancy rate, what their projected need for specialty nurses are. But I did not bring the individual nurse survey. And that's the one that asks what would incent them to work longer in the positions that they are, or to stay where they are, or not leave Oregon if they were planning to leave Oregon. So that's in the individual survey. I didn't bring all of the surveys. I brought you two examples, the two largest ones.
Okay.
But I can get those to you.
Thank you. Comments? Question?
Louise, you did a very admirable job of standing in. I know that's a difficult task sometimes, so we hope your colleague in Astoria is okay and suffering this natural disaster as well as possible. But you did a very good job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to digest these numbers a little bit because they're kind of not quite where I can get to what I'm looking at here to make sense out of them. You did a wonderful job in increasing the number of graduates.
Mm-hmm.
And the pipeline compared to physicians, which is about 12 to 14 years, is 4 years, but still a significant length of time. And the question is, you're trying to predict how many people are going to retire between now and let's pick the number 2025.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little difficult to predict that far out, but you're probably pretty close.
We asked them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The data that we have reported, we ask the nurses when they plan to retire.
And I'm not saying there are none of them are lying.
That's right. Or will they admit it?
Well, they admit it. Or, hold the R and the rest of it. But it's difficult to tell if how much that trajectory, these two trajectories are off from each other, and we need to look at that carefully. And if you can bring that back to us in the more simplified form for my brain, it would help, okay? Is if we need to ramp up the graduate rate even more, we need to know that now. We don't need to know it 6-7 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to know how well we're retaining. For the medical school, as an example, and this may be old information, we retain about half our physicians from the medical school. We don't have to leave the state. But we get a lot of from outside the state, too. So you're going to have all kinds of things about that. But nurses, I think, are much more likely to be retained in the state through our programs. They are. Yeah, community oriented, and that makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. And so my guess is your loss of graduates to outside the state are probably pretty minimal. And probably not a factor. So from that, I'm saying measuring the number of people we've got going into the program, going in and coming out of the program, is going to be very significant. Measuring that in medical school isn't as significant, but for nurses it is significant. So that'll give us one trajectory to look at. Mm-hmm. The other one is how accurate is the loss at the other side, and now how do we match those two up?
Well, as far, Senator Bates, as far as nurses leaving Oregon, the data that I had was looking at the licensure exam results, and the licensee has the opportunity to be licensed in one state through the exam, and then she has to be endorsed. We had very few apply for licenses out of the state, out of state. Most of them were on the borders, like Idaho and, part of Washington, maybe Southern California, but essentially they are staying in place.
I would guess that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I guess maybe to summarize it, I think the hope we would have as legislators is that for all of the allied fields in medicine, physicians and all the allied fields, that we understand where we are today, what the attrition rate is, and where the gap is, anticipating demand into the future, and that we have that in summary form, and if the Workforce Institute is maybe the place to coalesce that and bring that back to us, and then, of course, to have a reliable data upon which to make those judgments, and how do we make sure we get that data. So I think those are probably the two components of where we feel a shortfall is having that reliable data that gives us those projections into the future so we can make policy determinations. And thank you very much. Appreciate you coming today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How is Karen doing down there?
Apparently okay. Yeah, that they had their cell phone service and, you know, their landlines down. And last I knew, she was very happy because they bought a generator so they could have some light.
This is a very, very, very serious situation.
Yes.
Certainly for those residents, but all of Oregon. So yeah. Thank you for pinch hitting.
Thank you very much.
You just got a triple.
I see that next on our agenda is the update on the Oregon Health Fund Board, but Barney, we understand, is in a meeting, and so if we might, are we prepared to shift
right
to the next one?
Shift over. Yeah.
Right.
People have been prepared.
Okay. Health Professions Regulatory Board's data collection and application, Karen McLean and Lisa Dodson.
You know, Mr. Chair, while they're getting situated, the I was down there kibitzing with Senator Bates, and we were lamenting the fact we did not have a specific subgroup in 329 on workforce. And so,
yes,
I think that's something that this committee is going to have to play a larger role in, and maybe we should connect more closely with the Workforce Institute and utilize their good offices and infrastructure to move us forward. So, Rick, if you could make a note of that, I think this is obviously an area that is a critical component, because the one nurse made the point, if we figure out all the bells and whistles and weave the cloth of 1,000 threads and increase access. Access to what?
Limited delivery.
If you can't find a physician or a nurse or a clinic or a, whatever, then we're in the same suit.
It looks like the Institute is taking a very global look at this thing. We're looking at everything.
Well, we need to think and talk about how we can make sure that all comes together concurrent with this health fund board recommendations.
Yeah. Agree.
Okay, agree. Please proceed. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Morris, members of the committee. My name is Karen McLean. I'm the administrative director from the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I'm here on behalf of our executive director, who is unfortunately out of town due to a death in his family. I believe the question that we were asked to answer today is kind of a global look at a sample of health licensing boards and the kinds of data they collect on license applications. And as I was sitting here listening, I decided I really named this document wrong. I shouldn't have named it Healthcare Professional Licensing Board. It's really Healthcare Professional Licensing Data Collection Information. It's a sample of it. So I would not have included board because it's not a board. It's a bunch of boards. And it's not comprehensive. It's a sample. I had one of our staff go through and provide to you, it's this document here. I think you probably all have it. Just all the different kinds of fields of data that various boards collect and put into their databases, and I think that is what we were asked to find out. And you can see the totals, you know, sometimes there's every 10, always ask the name, you know, obviously. The kinds of data that might be helpful in a workforce survey would include the date of birth, the address, the current employer, the work history, and the licensure in other states. That would give, you know, a little bit from the data we currently collect. Those would be additional fields that would be helpful, I think, as you all look at this topic that we currently collect. In addition to that, Executive Director Gary Schnabel also asked a sample of these boards five questions, and they were, do you collect any data besides your license applications that could be remotely related to workforce? A number of them said they collect employment changes within nursing homes. They collect the number of educational service districts. RadTech said they voluntarily get the ethnicity information. Occupational therapy, aside from the general licensing information, they collect and track their numbers, and they've seen an increase in that field over the last 5 years. We asked how many of them were part of the AHEC workforce study back in 2000 to 2002, which I believe Lisa's going to speak about. And of the boards that we asked, only three of those boards were part of that. Are we hearing reports of the workforce shortage in the regulated professions currently? The nursing home administrators said that there's a tight supply in Oregon and that other states in the past and other states for the past biennia. The veterinary board indicates there's a shortage of large animal veterinarians in western Oregon and a shortage of certified veterinarian technicians statewide. So there's a variety of different kinds of answers that we've gotten. A lot of them indicated that they're working or the professional organizations locally are working on these issues. A lot of it ties to baby boomers, which has been mentioned earlier today. For radiologic technology, they indicate that approximately 33% fall into the 55 to 65 age group. The metropolitan areas are okay, but rural will be hit the hardest as they've struggled to get qualified technicians and have a low retention rate. 21% of the baby boomers live in rural Oregon, which is 499 of their licensees in that category. Clinical social workers, again, mentioned baby boomers. The interesting thing was occupational therapy said there is an issue in workforce, but they seem to be covered by temporary companies that send people to Oregon. And in that particular category, I thought that was an interesting response. Psychologist examiners, due to the insurance company reimbursement nationally, this is an issue with postdoctoral training programs as it is required for licensure, this training component. Rural Oregon is especially affected. And finally, the Board of Dentistry responded and said they're told there are shortages in certain areas. However, it's more of a shortage of the ability to pay for the service than the actual lack of the people to provide the services. So I thought that was an interesting response. Do we have plans to follow up or access workforce issues in the regulated professions? And again, Radiologic Technology Board indicated that it's important to look at the distance learning opportunities and to work with the community colleges to develop programs in their particular area. Currently, there are only three approved programs for radiologic technology programs in the state, in Klamath Falls, Albany, and Salem. And only one radiation therapy program, and that's in Portland, and there's a two-year waiting to get into any of those programs. So that's a pretty significant delay. The Board of Pharmacy, over the time, I've been with the board 6 years now, and I've heard about shortages in pharmacy, but I think it's a perception more than it's a reality. We have about 4,300 licensed pharmacists in the state of Oregon. Those that actually reside in Oregon and work in Oregon are really closer to about 3,200. And there is a new pharmacy school in the state of Oregon in the last year and a half at Pacific University. So they will have a first graduating class of about 65 people. They plan to go 65, 75, 95, or something like that over their first implementation of their classes. Their first class will graduate in 99. And so we're going to see more graduates coming out of Pacific University in the state of Oregon, which is great. There's about 75 to 100 that graduate out of OSU every year, out of the school, College of Pharmacy at OSU every year. So there's only two opportunities in Oregon to get pharmacy education. The last two that I had on my list here were clinical social workers, and they're collaborating with their National Association Oregon chapter, and the occupational therapy indicates that there's only one school in Oregon for occupational therapy. The last question that we asked was whether or not our statute defined or limited what data we could collect, and everybody indicated that that did not seem to be an issue. The statute doesn't really limit what kinds of data can be collected on behalf of a licensing board. So those were the kinds of things that we went out and asked people about. I hope that's helpful to the committee, and I would be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you. Is there anywhere that we have a comprehensive report on supply and demand for all of the healthcare professions?
Senator Morris, I believe the answer is no.
So I think that's the direction we're heading, if I'm correct. How do we get our hands around this, rather than anecdotal here, a bit in the piece here, so that we can understand really where these issues fall? Is that correct?
Yeah, a couple comments and probably a question. It's interesting that we don't have any single source to go to look at the workforce and healthcare sort of across the board, and we somehow picked on you guys, pharmacy board, say, hey, would you do a little survey for us?
Thank you.
That sort of speaks to itself that we've got no overriding thing here.
Yeah.
And then the information each of them is collecting, of course, is different.
Mm-hmm.
And most, and what's interesting, and some of it's helpful to us, age and numbers would be important. But as we said earlier in other testimony, how many of them are actually practicing, what kind of a practice they have, are they full-time, part-time, are they planning to retire, not retire, leaving? I mean, all those questions that we need to know so we can see the workforce is, that information is not really being obtained here. And those boards were not set up to do that initially.
Mm-hmm.
Their first requirement was to protect the public and to make sure people qualify to do what they're doing and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of a new thing for them. And with the explosion of the needs in healthcare, with our ability to do more and with the aging population, that's a big change for them. But obviously, most of them have not adjusted to, okay? And I wouldn't expect them to necessarily. They may need some direction from us, and it goes back to the question we had about the Board of Medical Examiners. We may want to be putting together with a collaborative approach from these people, a basic survey that not only goes to physicians, but to the other health providers too, and it's all the same, so the database can be looked at easily and quickly and understood no matter what your specialty is. Nothing against veterinarians here, but I'm a little more focused on human health than veterinary health, but that would be, if they chose to go, that'd be fine too. But it's very interesting. You've got a very strange cross matrix here of various information being collected, which tell me that there is no uniform way of looking at this right now, and we probably need to do that. And I don't know how you got stuck with this particular job, but
well, thank you very much.
Thank you for doing it. You did a great job.
Can I fill in that?
Yes.
I happened to be in cafe today when Gary Schnabel and Karen McLean were down there, and I had nobody to pick on, so they became the sacrificial lamb. But appreciate their efforts.
Yeah, it points up a real problem.
Yeah, it really does.
Well, and I have to thank my staff that helped put this together, because I was in a board meeting all week, and I was like, okay, let's put this together, because now Gary can't do it. So, you're right, Senator Bates. There isn't one specific way to look at it. I know that Lisa's going to talk about this from her perspective, but we participated in the surveys that she is going to be referring to, and there was a lot of additional data, but that's obviously out of date at this point. It was in 2002 that we did that workforce look at pharmacy specifically in conjunction with the AHEC studies that we were a part of. And so there's a lot of questions that can be asked, and my mind was just going everywhere just listening to the earlier speakers thinking, gosh, you know, even the workforce, healthcare workforce, that seems like maybe that's a good central location to start. So that was my impression as I listened to this.
Mm-hmm. Potentially we might ask they develop the tool, and then it might take legislation to say each of these boards will use this tool as part of their licensure process, and then we'll start getting information back that makes sense. My memory, and this is a little embarrassing, I think my licensure as a physician is every 2 years.
You should be applying right now.
I filled it out a couple of months ago and sent it in, so but I can remember, I think it's for 2 years, if I remember right?
Correct.
Thank you, Dr. Dawson. So it'll be a cycle like that for us. I mean, the next time, unfortunately, we're catching it right at the end of the cycle here, and if we want to catch the next cycle for physicians, it'd be 2 years away.
And pharmacists are annual, and we start in April, so it would be coming up.
There's some variation there amongst the various boards.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Dr. Dodson, what can you share with us today?
I'm Lisa Dodson. I'm the director of the Oregon Area Health Education Centers program, and if I may indulge 1 second here, I'd like to describe a few of my other roles just because it kind of informs where I'm coming from with my testimony. I am a former rural practicing physician. I practiced in John Day, Oregon prior to returning to the university. I am a member emeritus of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, which is probably what got me here today more than anything, and I am a current member of the Oregon Health Services Commission. So I come at this from a variety of legislative and organizational roles as well. May I approach and hand you a few things? What I just handed to Aaron, which I will give to all of you, are copies of the AHEC reports from 2000 and 2002. And much of the discussion that you've had earlier this afternoon can really be addressed best by looking at these forms. They are, Aaron, just random. They're one of each copy, not and so they can just look through and see. And there are some from 2000 and some from 2002. Just briefly, what the workforce assessment at that time. If you look at the second page of my handout, there is also a website there that has each of these reports for 2000 and 2002 that are available electronically, which
Excuse
is why.
Which report are you referring to?
I had a handout that looks with the AHEC.
This one?
No, it's.
With the blue.
That looks correct, yes. On the second page of that, there is a website, which is the AHEC website, which does have copies of each of these reports available electronically. So rather than load you up with lots of junk, I reference those there. The Oregon Health Workforce Project was a demonstration project which was developed to test the feasibility of conducting comprehensive coordinated survey of Oregon licensed health professionals. In 2000, the Oregon Area Health Education Center's program conducted a survey of more than 25,000 healthcare providers. The results of this survey offered valuable insights into the composition, practice patterns, and attitudes of health care providers in Oregon, and licensed healthcare providers in Oregon were surveyed by mail to gather baseline data regarding demographics, educational background, practice characteristics, workload, job satisfaction, and future career plans. Results were published in a series of descriptive reports, which I just provided to you, and are available on our website. Reports in 2000 and 2002. We did add pharmacy in 2002. It had been 6 reports, and in the 2002 there were 7. Partners in this endeavor were largely AHEC and the foundation, the Northwest Health Foundation, which provided most of the funding. If you look on the third page of my handout, there is a cost summary of how that was paid for. The whole cost of the 2-year project, which actually was really a four-year project by the time it was done through two licensing cycles, just over $250,000. About 50% of that was paid for by the Northwest Health Foundation grant, and about 50% was from AHEC. However, the licensing boards did all contribute their mailing and in-kind costs, which amounted to about $20,000 over the 2 years, and the Oregon Health Division contributed another $10,000, and then there were a few other smaller contributors as well. This is included mainly to give you an idea of a relative cost structure for such a project. Obviously, this was done now nearly a decade ago, and so costs would presumably be somewhat higher. What we really learned from this was that utilizing the licensing boards for the renewal process keeps the costs down, since they are already mailing, as Dr. Bates said, and enhances return rates. Typically, when you look at the way this is done around the country, some of them are mandatory and approach 100%, but even the ones that are not mandatory return a 60 to 80% survey rate, which is generally considered fairly good and accurate for survey purposes. From having been a member of the Board of Medical Examiners, and Karen can correct me if this is not accurately reflecting their opinion, but I believe that most of the boards do not believe that workforce planning is their main mission. They are there to protect the public and the citizens of Oregon and to regulate the practice of their specialty. The licensing boards are a superb place in which to gather the data, but not a good place in which to analyze it. If you look at the first page of my report, there is a long list of people who already collect data, and I think you've, Senator Morris, hit on earlier in your remarks that we have a lot of data out there, but it is very hit or miss, and it tends not to be longitudinal. We often respond to crisis. We have had an obstetrical crisis, so everybody ran around a few years ago surveying all the rural doctors to find out if they were going to quit delivering babies. We've had a malpractice crisis, so everybody went running around getting information on that, but none of it has a baseline or a data point that is easy to compare to, and therefore interpreting that data becomes quite difficult when you do it in crisis mode. So what we really need is to take all of these various players from state government, licensing boards, federal government, professional societies, the not-for-profit sector, the industry, and the for-profit sector, and find a repository for how to make sense out of the data that we are collecting. And again, my argument on behalf of the board would be that the boards are not and should not be in the position of analyzing the data. We need an outside party to be able to make sense out of all of this. I would be in complete agreement with Dr. Moorhead from earlier that two potential possibilities would be the Area Health Education Centers, because we've done this before, and the Oregon Health Workforce Institute. Prior to his departure, David Goldberg and I, who had been the previous director, had actually sort of hatched out a plan, which I think now is before their board, to look at a way to resume the consortium approach to this. If you look on the first page also, there's a long list of partners, and that is not an exhaustive list. I'm sorry, it's not on the first page, it's on the third page, of various partners that participated in the workforce project, and in each of the summaries documents, there's also a full listing of our partners.
Thank you very much. Do you have a sense of whether it's a collaboration between AHEC and the Institute, or one or the other, or...
I think neither of us are very territorial about it. I think that the thing that the AHEC brings that is missing from much of the other discussion is the educational perspective. We are in the business of training healthcare providers in the AHEC and predominantly focusing on care to the underserved, rural and urban underserved alike. And so there's that perspective that is omitted if you look at other sectors. Often it doesn't relate to the product of the health professions training programs. I think the nursing schools through OCNI and some other things have done a very good job of relating their licensing information and things back to the education system, as you heard earlier, are probably an example of how it can be done well. And AHEC has been a player at all of those nursing functions, just like we are for most of the other health professions in the state. So in answer to your question, I think either or both.
Sounds like a collaborative.
Absolutely.
Because there are strengths in both.
Absolutely. I think if we learned one thing from our previous projects is that in order to do this well, you must have widespread collaboration everybody, it's the hammer and nail phenomenon. You know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and you solve your own problem, but you don't necessarily address the larger scope that I think is really what you're after.
So that, so we did this effort in 2000, and it was concluded in 2002?
Correct.
And then we didn't essentially pick up on this until...
We did not, because the funding ran out. And AHEC sustained a fairly large loss of funding. North of South Foundation could not sustain it at that level on their own, and it basically died for lack of funding. And that would be my other recommendation in, or emphasis, I guess, is that grant funding can be a very useful tool to initiate a project, but it makes it very challenging to sustain this kind of effort.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick comments, and I'm going to make comments, and we'll see if you agree with what I'm saying. Dr. Dotson, feel free to disagree.
Okay.
AHEC has done a great job for the state, and their focus has been on education, education, education. In order to decide what kind of education you wanted to expand into or increase or decrease, whatever you've done, you had to do some surveys to know what the need was. And
correct.
So by default, you've had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And information now is 6, 7, 8 years old and probably somewhat antiquated, and even then the information wasn't complete. The Institute seems to be more focused on actually surveying and understanding what our workforce looks like and what the need is going to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I'm seeing here from them. Although they're kind of a new group for me, so I'm not sure.
At the time when these surveys were done, that Institute did not exist.
I understand.
And so it may have a broader arching, certainly, scope than the AHEC has.
Right. And my sense is, and I don't know what the funding streams for both these organizations are, AHEC has been supported primarily by OHSU out of the limited funds they have, and they've sustained huge cuts in the last 5 years, so I'm sure you felt it at your operational level.
Yes.
Big time. But it seems to me that if we can get a collaboration going between the licensing boards and probably make it a requirement of licensure that this survey tool be filled out, the tool that would probably be produced by you and by the Institute, that the Institute gather that information and probably do analysis with you on it, and that would then guide you what you have to do in your mission of education. That would be probably a collaborative effort that would have some chance of getting good data, good information, and good recommendations out. I'm thinking that kind of collaborative has to occur to really make this thing drive through, and that will probably take some legislative effort on our part to put that together for you. I feel legislation coming out of this to make all those things happen.
I completely agree on the collaborative aspect of what you said. My sense from knowing folks on the Board of Medical Examiners is that none of the boards are really resistant to doing this. I think that what they are looking for is guidance as to scope. What is it that we would like? All of the boards for the licensing boards were at the table when we did these surveys in 2000 and 2002, were unbelievably cooperative, donated in-kind staff time and a lot of mailing costs and other things that they absorbed in order to do this. So my sense of it is that do not object at all to doing it. It is simply what becomes of the data, can it be protected as to identity and some of the other things that we obviously can care about as physicians, and can they reliably give that data to somebody else to make sense out of, because I don't think they have the staff or the belief it is their job to analyze the workforce as much as it is to respond to the workforce that presents.
And then another area that we've not addressed is the whole bevy of researchers in the employment department.
I did mention that. The employment division tends to look at healthcare workforce or any workforce in a very different way than physicians or licensing boards look at it. And again, they add a great deal to the discussion, although they tend to look at it as unfilled positions without really, that's their little box, is how many do we need to stick into our to fill our positions, because that's what employers care about. They aren't really looking forward and backwards. They're looking at what do I need today. And, again, that's a very useful perspective, but it does not add to the long-term planning as well as other activities might.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. With the Board of Nursing kind of, I guess, being now the platinum level of data collection, and then the regulatory boards having kind of spread, is it possible, because I can envision then trying to come up with some kind of uniformity in a survey device where you're not, like, pulling down the nursing board, where they can still use their own data? Is it, I mean, I'm trying to envision what potentially some of the obstacles might be, and is it possible for you guys to come up with something which can be used across the board, that we're comparing apples and apples?
I would say we already did it. In fact, one of the handouts that I gave you was one of the survey instruments from the 2002 survey, and it is fairly uniform across all of the specialties, obviously within some margin. The training length of time is obviously adjusted, et cetera. But basically, those survey instruments were already developed in that collaborative model for 2000 and 2002, and it is much easier now, yes, correct, to resurrect that and sort of buff it up for the purposes that we are looking at in 2008 or 9 or 10. And so I think it is going to be far easier in a collaborative model to do that this time than it would have been, or than it was in the early days when there was a lot of discussion and struggle about what needed to be included.
Well, as one who is personally resistant to surveys, it's more than one page.
Well, if I may add one.
But it is not long.
It's not. If I may add, as a practicing physician, I, and Dr. Bates, you can agree with me or not, I would say that on average, I probably receive somewhere between 6 and 10 surveys to complete a month, from everything from pharmaceutical industry to my own specialty board to you
delete,
name it.
Delete.
Well, and it is, and it's very challenging. And that's one of the problems with collecting data and why survey results are, or survey returns are low, is because physicians are experiencing, and probably other healthcare providers are experiencing, survey fatigue. It takes time out of a busy day. We do the best we can, but nobody's got the amount of time that may be necessary. And combining efforts and getting the most information, figuring out what's already out there that someone else has done, and then adding to a baseline of data is probably a far more sensible approach if we're going to move forward with this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I might add, I would agree that totally that the – at least for our board, I came about 6 months after, right before we were getting ready to do this, and participated in. I know that we didn't have any problem helping with it. We were glad to participate and really interested in the information that it gleaned. In the day and age of web surveys, that's a tool that might be considered, although I don't know what the response numbers would come out as. And the fact that, you know, postage, I think, has gone up 3 times since then, since 2002. And so it's really expensive to add those additional components into a mailing for a licensing board. It may also, the other component that I would add is, if there are additional fields of data that are going to be collected, it would affect all the licensing databases themselves. And so there would probably have to be some retooling there, and that would, of course, have financial impact to the agencies. So just considerations to think about. But I know that we would be happy to participate in any way that we can.
I would also just, on a final comment, if I may, remind the committee of the, you know, no good deed going unpunished mantra. I have here a survey that the AHEC office completed regarding Senate Bill 786 in 2002, which was a simple attempt to analyze the ethnic composition of the workforce. And it was a 3-question survey that went out, very simple, asking about your race, and other languages that you speak. The response rate turned out to be extremely high to that survey, which surprised everybody at first, until we realized that about 80% of the people who responded did not answer the questions, but instead sent back comments, of which I will read a few. Is it legal for you to ask me these questions? I don't answer these questions. It's none of your business. It's none of your blank business. Pages and pages of comments from providers. So I think it points out again that this was a well-intentioned device that was very, very badly received because it was done in isolation from any context at all. And so, again, I think putting things in context and in a larger framework that everybody understands and is moving forward along the same spectrum will make things easier for all of you and definitely better in terms of the information you're seeking.
Excellent point. Was that your bill, Senator Wesley?
Well, my comment is that, I mean, you know, for a senator that's never received one of these emails or correspondences that had the you blank, blank. Yeah. Let me explain what those blanks are.
Well, thank you. You have helped fill in some very important pieces of information and gaps. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I think I see Barney has arrived. Are we too far off schedule?
Oh, no, Rick. No, we're
doing okay?
We're fine.
Okay. Are you ready, Barney? We'll learn about the Health Fund Board.
Yeah, Lisa, excuse me for being away during your presentation, but I was missioned with going out and finding Barney, and I did. You know, he was the only patron at Magoo's, you know, and they were mad when I took him, but, you know, it's okay. Hi, Barney.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barney Spade. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Fund Board. Pleased to be with you this afternoon. Thought I would very briefly give you an update of where we are. The board has will be having its fourth meeting next week on the 12th in Wilsonville. It has met on three previous occasions, one an organizational meeting, and then the meetings on October 30th and November 6th were kind of background. The 30th was kind of a mini retreat for all day, and then it was continued for with more background information on various topics on the 6th. The meeting on the 12th is, in addition to some organizational issues regarding committee charters and things like that, the board will be meeting in joint session with the members of the Delivery System Committee and members of the Health Policy Commission who are not otherwise on one of the committees, focusing on the issue that I know you've all heard about in the past and is of great interest in the work of the board, and that is the some call it primary care revitalization, others call it the medical home, the development of a concept of a medical home. But to hear from folks from both the provider community who are organizing some of these new models for primary care delivery and what they hold as far as opportunities in the future for improved primary care, improved chronic disease management, et cetera, and also a panel from various insurers, both Medicaid insurers and commercial insurers that are involved in demonstrations of reimbursing for this kind of care. So the board's going to be looking at that. All six committees of the board are organized and operational. The Benefits Committee will be having its third meeting next week. The Delivery System Committee has had two meetings, and special work group of the Delivery System will be launched in the next few days, looking at the whole issue of what's called a Quality Institute. If you recall, in Senate Bill 329, it directed OHPR to develop a model Quality Institute for gathering information on both clinical and efficiency performance measures, et cetera. A lot of work has already been done in that area, and this work group will, in a very short time, probably within 2 months, come back with a set of recommendations for the Delivery Committee to review and pass on to the board. The Enrollment and Eligibility Committee has met, will be meeting its fourth meeting next week, looking at standards of eligibility along particularly income lines. The Federal Laws Committee met for its first time last week and is organized, and we have a strategy for reaching out and receiving information from stakeholders on the impact of federal policy as it may inhibit Oregon's goals in moving forward. The Finance Committee has met, will be meeting next week for the second time, and we have an exchange work group looking at not just the issue of an insurance exchange, but looking at the broader implications of actually changes in the regulation of the insurance market that might have to occur in the context of an individual mandate. And then lastly, the Sixth Committee, Health Equities, met for the first time last week and is underway. So we have six committees, over 90 people. The chairs of the six committees, of course, are ex officio members of the board. If you think the first meeting of the board was October 2nd, and now we're into basically 2 months later, we've got a lot of committee work underway. I would characterize it as that they're getting background information, reviewing the charges that the board has given them, getting kind of their thoughts organized about how they want to proceed, particularly in the December's a tough month. We'll get a few meetings in the next few days, but then we've got meetings scheduled into January, February. The board is actually scheduled through March. We're working on April, May, and June board meeting dates for the board, and with an understanding that we probably, when we get into the May, June time frame, the board will have to meet twice a month, because we'll be then in the framework, in the timeline of beginning to receive recommendations and have to integrate those recommendations into a draft comprehensive plan. On some other fronts, I just note that within the next few days, hopefully, have a really small and quick turnaround contract to get a strategic communications plan for 2008 developed, and then we'll be looking to work with a number of organizations, but including the Healthcare Reform Collaborative, on how we execute that communications plan, looking at things like how do we let the Oregonians know of the work that the board is doing while it's doing it. But in addition to what is our communications and outreach plan for the summer and early fall, when we actually have a draft plan out for public comment, as we get to the period of developing a report for delivery on 10-1. We're in the process of also consummating a relationship with the consultants that we want to use in the area of looking at things like a pay-or-play payroll tax and the various economic modeling that comes with that, and also any kind of insurance reforms that would need to be considered in light of if we were to have an individual mandate. There's a lot of technical issues that some national consultants have been through. The group we're looking at, Rick Curtis from the Institute of Health Policy Solutions out of Washington, D.C., has spent the last 9 months almost on a daily basis in Sacramento working with both the legislature and the governor's office on the California reform packages, which are perhaps within the next few days something may be agreed upon. Kind of wavers between very close to nothing's happening. You know how that is. And I think they're in their second special session. But there's great interest among a lot of parties down there working collaboratively for a major reform package. And if it does come out, it'll be very interesting for us to look at the board, to look at the components of that. Many are similar to the kinds of things we're thinking about that come out of the Oregon Health Policy Commission's recommendations. And Mr. Curtis and his folks have a lot of background now of the kind of various issues that can come up in a Western market. The reason I'm interested in California is because it's quite different. Its market is quite different than Massachusetts, much more. While it's 10 times larger than the state of Oregon, the market characteristics other than scale are very similar. I'm pleased that we're organized and operational. We have staff for all of the committees. It is a big deal to have these many committees meeting and to have staff supporting them. The volunteer support from the members of the committee is outstanding. It really is energizing to see the number of people who are willing to commit over the next 6 to 9 months a good deal of their time on thinking through a lot of these issues. So. Let me stop there, and if there are specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Several, Barney, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just for a moment jump off the track a little bit here? Colorado has just made a their group has made a recommendation of the legislature. Could you
give
us? I was
thinking about saying that.
Yeah. Well, give you a segue. Can you make a comment on it for us?
Well, first of all, I will try. I've checked their website to get kind of a gleaning of what they're recommending. And we have staff working to develop a background paper that I'd be happy to share with the committee so that the board at some point can understand what the Colorado recommendations are. I do know that it has its components do include an individual mandate. I don't know their potential for or exactly which choice they've used for a revenue funding. They've got some proposals, very broad-based proposals on benefit packages. So in many ways, they're looking at the solution, not unlike the way we are. The other interesting thing about Colorado is that they had five or six models that they were looking at after kind of a statewide survey of various approaches to healthcare reform. And have chosen this one. But beyond that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I don't have all of the details.
What's your understanding?
My understanding is fragmentary also, but my understanding was that I was surprised, and I may be surprised that my information is wrong, that they have chosen to recommend a payroll tax to fund the system.
That could be. I'm just not certain of that.
Okay. I'm not totally certain either. Right. So, but that was my understanding. Okay.
But I do know that it was a comprehensive plan looking at issues of getting the uninsured covered. They have some interesting benefit package choices that we want our benefit committee to look at, along with some of the benefit options that other states already have in place, like I think I've mentioned here, the Washington Basic Health Plan, things like that. So we've got some, we've got some work done elsewhere. And I think one of the interesting things that we can glean from Colorado is just not what they did or what their Blue Ribbon Commission is recommending, but to have some at least telephone interviews with some of the staff there to understand why did they go this way, what was the kind of compelling rationale for choosing this way versus that way, kind of thing. And it was a large Blue Ribbon Commission. Multidisciplinary business. I believe that there were, political leaders and business leaders, labor leaders, et cetera.
Well, the one proposal that they analyzed that was the most controversial had the greatest coverage and the most dramatic impact on costs was, of course, the single payer system.
Single payer. Yeah.
Wrapping all of the sources into one. And then essentially modeling their Medicaid as the basic accountable health plan model. And it would be interesting, I think, for our next meeting to have maybe a little more insight into what they have, in fact, recommended to their January session. So any other comments or questions?
Comment, question. The first comment is, Barney, I know I speak on behalf of not just many legislators, but many Oregonians who want to thank you for this, yeoman's work and incredible job you have done. I mean, we functionally handed you some, blueprints where some of the lines weren't connected and said, here, build this ship.
You wanted a ship? I thought it was an airplane.
And
let me make a note of
it. Kind of build a ship, but then, and you've done that, and in the required timeline, and it's just the logistics of it were daunting, and so the first phase here is, pretty well done.
It's Act One.
Yeah. And so now the goal that we've got our little balsa wood and paper mache ship built is to sail it across the daunting sea. This is the real work, the difficult work. I will ask the question and require that you not answer it, but... are there any areas of organized resistance to our task at hand? And I ask that only to say that, we as a legislative body are deeply concerned, invested in the success of this effort. This is not
an issue that's going to be easy or comfortable, and everyone has not only some vested interest in how it turns out, but we have a vested interest in its successful conclusion. Because as married as we are to our current ways of doing business, and I say that word specifically, the business of providing health care, this has got to change. You know, this can't be one of these deals where, you know, the most successful entity or stakeholder, you know, is the one that's, you know, thinks they're successful because they are last to the bottom. They are still going to hit bottom, and we're all going to hit it together. You know, this is very serious. It revolves around cutting cost, changing behaviors, both professional and personal, and changing the entire delivery system of how we deliver health care. This is not a casual or cursory or trite undertaking. This isn't just our economic futures or the exponential rising health care costs. You know, we're eating more and more of our business's profitability. It's also the moral issue of providing adequate, affordable, effective health care to all of our citizens. Now, I don't mean to sound angry, but part of me is. Because in asking of my question, are there any areas of organized resistance, I know some are developing. Those areas, those stakeholders, those people have got to understand that just because they're at the in the luxury cabins on the ship and they're far away from the hole in the boat and their feet aren't wet yet, it doesn't mean that their boat isn't sinking also. It is time. So I want to, again, thank you, Barney, you know, for the...
I will respond if
the
I...
The logistical balancing act. See, he does not follow instructions. I ask him not to answer the question, and here he goes. But please, go ahead.
Well, I appreciate... I think that may be the first time in my career that I've been asked a question and then said I don't have to answer it. I want to comment on the question. From my perspective, and in working with a very broad spectrum of interest groups, stakeholders, concerned citizens, etc., I would characterize the kind of the environment that I feel we're in right now is, I think there is a broad concern across all spectrums, about the status quo, about its sustainability. And I don't believe you're incorrect, Senator Westland. I interpret part of your comments is some are much more deeply concerned than others because of kind of where they stand within the system. We said about purchasers, it could be said about hospitals, it could be said about physicians, insurers, et cetera. I don't sense right now organized resistance. What I sense is a concern about trying to understand, you know, where are we going to go and what are we trying to do, and how well both will the committees and the recommendations they develop, and the board, of course, can take those recommendations and modify them. How hard and well will they listen to the various perspectives and the implications, etc. So we're early in the game. I think that everybody realizes to a large degree we're trying to do this in a very public manner. There's going to be a lot of staff work where we put up straw person concepts and things like that, and people will comment on and the committees, and et cetera. So right now I'm not feeling organized resistance. But I do think, and I guess this is where both the deliberations of the committee at the end of the day and its recommendations that it passes into this building, I believe that everyone does feel across that spectrum that everyone's going to have to change somehow. I think this issue of there's a bit of change or a lot of change or there's change in it for all of us, there's going to have to be a give and take by everybody. Kind of there's no one entity or small group of entities are held harmless. I think part of this is trying to find the balance of a plan that is viewed across all those spectrums as both equally painful relative to what various groups have to take on to change, but that the outcome of that, if people will can add it up and see a better future, that's where I think the goal is to try to have this the sum of whatever the parts of change are be bigger in the total outcome for the good of Oregon, for the good of the healthcare systems in our communities, et cetera. So I remain hopeful. I'm not naive about the work that we have to do. I'm not cynical about it. I'm old enough and I think been around long enough to know that everyone is listening to these concepts from their own point of view, but also I think are trying in a goodwill at this point of trying to connect them to see how potentially would a change system look and would it work effectively. So those are my comments back.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? You know, since he answered the question I asked him not to answer.
Ask him another one.
I'm not. I'm going to make a comment, and then I'll be quiet, maybe. I appreciate your characterization. I think that's an accurate summation where I take exception or have some umbrage, or maybe say it more gently, where I hope you are right, is I don't think everyone's going to have to make equal sacrifices. The way the market, the way the delivery system has developed over the years, you know, there are areas where we're going to have more improvement in some areas than in others. So it's not an equal contribution, you know, an equal amount of change.
Hear what you're saying.
Some are going to have to change more, and it is going to be more painful. All are going to have to change. Everybody's got to put skin in the game. But, you know, someone's going to have to put, you know, the cuticle in, and another's going to have to put half a hand. I mean, this is not an equitable solution in terms of individual entity stakeholders, you know, contributions to the solution. I wish it was that simple, and I know you do too.
I think you registered the angst of all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make a couple comments, and there'll be two questions at the end. So,
okay.
And I do want you to try to respond to them if you can. Son of a gun. And Senator Westland has covered a lot of the ground. I want to cover race, so that'll save us some time. We started this process off with something that our chair said to us a year and a half ago about the need for not incremental change, but radical change. And I'm hoping that theme is still being followed all the way through. You have managed to put together 90 people in 90 days to do a really important job, and I greatly appreciate your efforts on that. I don't know if you've got an ulcer yet or migraine headaches, but you've done a great job. I appreciate also the number of people who volunteered for those jobs and the fact that a lot of people were disappointed even that they couldn't get on the committee they wanted to get on or wouldn't get on the committee at all. And we had that much interest in doing it. I mean, when we started this process, we thought we might have to go out and beat the woods to find people, and there was no problem, obviously. So you've had to do a lot of things that were difficult already. As far as personnel is concerned, I know you'll have more coming up. Having said those things, I'll make one comment and more, and then I want to ask a couple of questions. One of the subcommittees, the Finance Committee, you and I have talked about already. And that particular committee, I believe, is on track for looking at the right issues. I am concerned that the representation of that committee may still be a little weak from the point of view of small business. You've done a great job of embedding throughout the committees the small business community. And when we talk about what Senator Westland just talked about, somebody putting in a cuticle, somebody putting in a hand, the small business community may be one of the communities that will be hardest hit by this. I'm not asking you to change committee, and I'm not asking you to change personnel in that committee, but just be aware that in the finance committee, I have a little bit of concern about the number of people representing small business in there that is rather low. Not a big criticism, just to let you know. And I know you're aware we've had the conversation before. The things I want to ask you more about are this. When you look at all the plans going on across the country, the one part that is very different in Oregon is we're talking about changing the delivery system. The rest of them are talking about how changing financing, how to save money administratively. But nobody else that I know of is talking about the real core issue of what drives healthcare costs at such a high level in this country and drives down outcomes, and that's the delivery system itself. The delivery committee is huge. And I'd like to hear a comment from you at this very early point of how you think they're starting to function and what your hopes are for them over the next several months. So that's the first question. The second question goes back to what Senator Westland was talking about. Right now we're still in the process where everyone's saying we've got to make change, we're all willing to put some skin in the game, but there's a little thing about not in my backyard that has not popped up yet, but it's going to pop up pretty quick. When these subcommittees start making serious recommendations, it gets into somebody's backyard. And I would like to hear about anybody's backyard problem as soon as it pops up. And I would ask you to answer this question. When you hear something of that nature happen, I will ask you to inform this committee immediately, because that's the beginning of the political process we have to deal with.
Let me address the finance committee. We do have on the finance committee, and some of the changes on the finance committee or the additions to the finance committee were prompted by at the request of the board. We have two small business persons on the committee. Both of them are active in their respective chambers of commerce, one in Bend and one here in Salem. We have also some business people who are connected both through the Oregon Business Council, which I know is a large business organization, but also through either AOI or the OBA, Oregon Business Association. We are also, through the work of the chair of the board, Bill Thorndike, and others, have already begun, and it will continue to reach into not just through committee representation, but through active outreach and conversation as we move issues forward, to work directly with associations or subcommittees of the associations. And Jonathan, I was ill one day, but Jonathan Ader, who's the vice chair, met with the health committee of the Oregon Business Association to tell them about the work. We will be continuing that in a both formal and informal way, not waiting until the end that here's the plan, but asking for comment as we move along. I can appreciate your comments, and I appreciate hearing your comments. The delivery system, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates is and the lead staff for the delivery system is sitting behind me, Dr. Janine Smith. It is a large committee, and the interesting thing is that when I said this in one of the earlier meetings, when I initially was planning all of this work with Janine and others in the August, September, early October time frame, I was thinking of committees of 9 to 11, maybe 13 at the most, because there's a certain kind of dysfunctionality that you get when you get much bigger. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have 20 now. We have 20 on the committee. It's a large committee. I don't believe that it's, and I wouldn't have gone this route if I thought it was going to become dysfunctional. I think on the delivery system is a key area of endeavor, and its work is actually being supported very early on from a philosophical sense by members of the board. In fact, the officers of the board met with the chairs of both the Finance and Delivery Committee together. We're still hammering out a charter that has great specificity in the areas of interest that focus on areas of cost containment, system redesign. I mean, one board member literally said, this whole package, this concept of a comprehensive plan is not going to fly if we don't have some real strategic plans for changing the or what I call bending the cost curve year over year that we all believe in, that the business community believes in, that citizens believe in, that insurers believe in, et cetera. The priority interest, then we've been hammering this out that we're looking at. I already said that here's kind of the agenda, the major agenda, and this is just the beginning. We're not trying to limit them, but these are the concepts of priority interest to the board to kind of quote a draft charter. Revitalizing primary care, strategies for comprehensive, coordinated, sustained clinical management of chronic disease. We know where we spend the money. We need to organize chronic disease management better. New reimbursement models that move from fee for encounter to financial incentives for outcomes. Health information technology, either through public policies or public-private collaborations, to increase the rate of diffusion and use of health information technology, and also to ensure interoperability. We'll have a committee, actually the governor's putting together a health information infrastructure committee called HIAC that will be taking that on. And feeding into the delivery system reform. Information transparency, and we're looking specifically to the Oregon Quality Institute and all of the issues that come about in getting better information, reports on information on performance of the delivery system, and we have a work group on that. I mentioned that earlier. We had a presentation, and the board on its proactive basis said, we had a presentation by John McConnell, economist from OHSU, and some of you may have been there. If not, it's on our website. But he made the observation that a substantial portion of the year-over-year cost increases in this country are a result of new technologies. And we don't have to be anti-new technology. His counsel, I thought, was most wise. He said, we're not looking to be Luddites in this, or Luddites, I guess is the way you say it, but we do need to find better ways to moderate the introduction of technology so that we understand how to use it in the first or second year as opposed to spending for technology on that cost curve for 10 years and then suddenly find out that all of the double-blind studies say it's only good for 10% of the population. And so this whole issue of looking at technology from a balanced point of view, and I've written this up, is to assure that the added value of a new clinical technology is broadly understood and that we avoid inappropriate diffusion and utilization. The interesting thing, Mr. Chairman, in talking about this, and Dr. McConnell said this, we have something in our gene code already. It's the Health Resources Commission that was created 15 years ago. Now, and there's a lot of other models like that. Minnesota has some models where we can look at those and say, how do we make those work better? How do we make them more broad-based so that the private purchaser, the private insurance company, the provider community can work on these issues together? We're looking at health, public health and prevention, particularly in the area of obesity and activities, and then the whole issue around end-of-life care. That's a pretty stiff agenda for change right there, and I think some of it can be handled at the full committee level, some of it can be handled by some of the sub-work groups that I've talked about. Some of it may be done through some informal staff work that we bring to the committee, background information, and we can move some of these can move faster than others. Some of them, by their very nature, are controversial, and we know where we're working on the primary care. That's a combination of not just what kind of models are out there, what are the criteria for a medical home, and then how quickly and how willing are the insurers, both Medicaid insurers and private sector insurers, to take on a new framework for paying for care. I think there's a real interest on the part of the business community or public and private purchasers to say, yeah, we'd pay for that. Right now, though, we have to understand there's going to be a period of time where you may pay more as you get through a transition. On the NIMBY issue, Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, I would ask that you give me the following flexibility. I'd like to work a little bit out behind the barn with the NIMBYs when I hear about the NIMBYs. to really understand what the basis of. I mean, I think a lot of this work done through a board like the Health Fund Board in a setting that's not formal legislative setting gives the opportunity for us to be able to understand why are people assuming the posture they're assuming. And I don't want to be less than honest with you that I'll come to you when I feel there's a potential problem that is kind of beyond rational debate. But I think part of this process is identifying where the NIMBYs are and talking with them and getting small groups together to understand, you know, are there ways we can make it work and things like that. Is that a fair response?
Mr. Chair, can I follow?
Yes.
Yeah, and that is a fair response, and I'll accept that. Just don't get too far down the track before we, you know, if you run into a problem, don't get too far down the track if you're not making progress with these people.
Well, I think, you know, let me make another observation about this because, you know, the board, this is very, I'm really proud of the board we have. As many people have said when they first appointed, these folks aren't the usual suspects, and they clearly aren't. We have some very good business minds, but they are also deeply engaged in their community on a kind of the community ethic, the social contract, if you will. We have good representation from labor and from communities of color, et cetera. I think the interesting thing that's going to happen is that when we get into the June-July timeframe when the board is hearing recommendations, and the recommendations, many of these recommendations may be framed as that there's a consensus to do this, we think the board should do this, but there's kind of a minority opinion over here, and the board will, I hope, staff's job will make sure that the board hears the range of opinion as we're putting the draft recommendations together. And I think that's going to be the first opportunity where people who don't agree, I hope, and we will ask them explicitly. I think one of my jobs is to give the board the chance to understand where people don't agree with a particular recommendation. To get to Senator Westland's perspective of, you know, are they just unwilling? What's the basis of their unwillingness? What's the basis of their opposition or lack of the support, whatever? And I think the board will actually push that process, knowing these as a group of individuals who, in four meetings, are really coming together. I think they're going to be really tough-minded about, and will come at the end of the day with a set of recommendations, listening to everybody. I think they take the charge that's within 329 is that they're to act what's in the best interest of Oregon. And what they may put forward to this legislature may not be uniformly supported by some groups out there. I don't know whether that's a... I want to get as much consensus around key concepts of reform as possible, but I also want you to know that I'm not in a position to make it happen, but I'm in a position as a staff person to advise the committee that if they think it's the right thing to do, even with people that are opposing it, that they should do what they think is the right thing to do, and then with them, staff will help explain to you and the rest of the public why they chose that.
Which is a segue to my last question.
Okay.
There's two important conversations that need to occur as you progress down this trail. One is a conversation between the board and the legislature. I'm not quite sure how to make that venue happen. You've got 90 legislators, and we have to have them have some understanding of what's going on.
Right.
And what the outcomes of that, of those recommendations would be. We need to have that discussion of how to make that happen. The other discussion, which is probably a bigger and more important discussion, is one that Senator Westland and I started during the last session. That's a discussion with the public. We made 27, I lost track, how many stops around the state?
25.
And big groups, small groups. But that conversation has to get started once the board has progressed to the point that they have an idea of what they're going to recommend. And that's going to take some time, too. And I expect it'll be similar to what Senator Westland and I did, similar to what we did with the original Oregon Health Plan, and that's going out around the state.
Mm-hmm. We are, and I will, you know, I don't know exactly when you're meeting next, but I will be at one of your next meetings or in the February special session, be able to lay out with you what our communication plan is, and we'll be working with groups. You know, we don't have a lot of money. We can do some of this on our own, but we have there is an amazing amount of support from a wide range of information of organizations, not advocacy organizations, community-based organizations, insurance companies, of saying, you know, we'll help you in organizing community outreach and receiving public comment back. So I'm very hopeful that, you know, this is going to be out there in the public discussion in the July, August, September timeframe. On the first part, I agree with you, and I can only hearken back to a comment that in a meeting that Representative Greenlick was at, and I give him the credit, it was his idea, is that during the interim it may be very important to get small groups of legislators, and I know it's tough during the interim, but, you know, in the evening for pizza 4 or 5 and get updates, if not from the whole board, from a representative of the board and from some staff about here's what we're looking at and why. They can understand how we're progressing, and particularly when we get into where we have draft recommendations, to be able to brief either an informal, I think preferably the informal conversations where there can be questions of why this and what's the basis for that. That's also part of this communications plan that I'd like to work with the chair and with you and others in this building, because it's not just the, I mean, with all due respect to all of you, it's not just all us old hats that have been in the healthcare venue. I think there are a lot of people in the public generally, in various stakeholder groups that aren't so connected to healthcare, but also in this building, people who specialize in other policy domains to understand what's, you know, what's up.
Okay. Thank you. I have one more ministerial type question. It's a concern that I've had. No matter what we do, there's going to have to be some kind of actuarial modeling done.
Yes.
And I'm concerned about the time frame, you know, to condense all of these variables into a plan of action recommendation and then actually model that and have that available for the 09 session. Is that practically possible?
It is in this sense, and let me tell you what the game plan looks like right now, Mr. Chair. Through Rick Curtis and also Professor Jonathan Gruber at MIT, the team that did the California modeling, we intend to be able to use those folks in the January, February, March, April, and even into May of integrating. We'll start with some what I call proxy numbers. We will start with, you know, what's the average cost of a health insurance policy per member per month, that kind of thing, while we may be waiting for the benefits committee for some principles that come out of benefits. But we can begin that modeling, and we can build two or three scenarios using that, what's called micro-simulation modeling, to understand, for example, on a payroll tax payer play, what would the uptake potentially be given the assumptions that go into this. It's a very I don't know a lot about it, but it works pretty well. The turnaround time is very quick. In fact, the support that Dr. Gruber's given to the California legislature, and unlike the work we're doing, which is kind of get to the best recommendation with the resources, when you're in a legislative body where you're kind of making, you know, trades or asking for different approaches, they're actually getting nightly turnaround. On the other revenue issues, some of the other revenue choices we'll have some of that modeling done. That's a little easier to do. Some of the economic modeling on various tax approaches is easier to do than, say, the pay or play payroll tax. But I believe we have, both with the resources that have been appropriated, and I'm out looking for some donations to be able to, within the report, both do a fair job at the economic modeling relative to the impact on health care. And I think I've said to this committee, I think the other piece is our recommendation, the recommendations of the board and what we deliver to 09. We also need to have some macroeconomic evaluation of what does this mean to Oregon's overall economic vitality. I think we need both. I mean, the Gruber work is to look at what happens with a payroll tax relative to how many people get enrolled and what would the costs and things like that. Whatever tax recommendation or tax recommendations the board would ultimately come up with, I'm also hoping to have some funds to be able to do some high-level macroeconomics, because I think that's one of the questions that's always going to have to be asked about new revenue in healthcare or new revenue elsewhere. What's the impact on the overall economy? So it's, you're right, the timing is tight. There are some interesting models, though, that help us think through this, that we're not flying blind. And we have some experience from other states, and the kind of questions they've asked and the kind of problems they've confronted is that one of the things I feel good about is we'll take a lot of that learning with us as we begin to shape these scenarios. So we're not kind of starting with ground zero. I was just talking with Rick Curtis the other day, and he said that one of the things, I've learned so much in the last 6 months about the kinds of questions that policymakers want to have answered. Yeah, and how we frame, you know, the models to make that work. So we'll have a more experienced team than we had, you know, even a year ago. And they're good people. They're very knowledgeable people. So I hope that's responsive.
Very good.
I would also anticipate, it's one of the things I think you all have planned, is if the recommendations of the board are part of the 09 legislative agenda, which I hope they will be, there will probably be a requirement to have some modeling done, if not by the Department of Revenue or Legislative Fiscal or something, but by some of these other folks that have done it for state government, other state governments. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent. I think summary.
Thank you. And if I don't see you all, happy holidays.
Well, thank you.
See you back at Magoo.
Dr. Smith, if you wish to. Okay. Well, thank you. We're just a few minutes past our scheduled agenda, but before we move on to the OHSU Medical School, I want to make sure that we have a clear understanding of where we're going with this database collection and who's on first and who's on second and what role this committee will play. My concern is we've heard deficiencies. We have an opportunity. Who's going to pick it up? Who will participate? And what's the timeline? Rick, do you have any suggestions on maybe how we approach this?
Well, one thing discussed, Mr. Chair, was possibly it sounds like there's a pretty broad-based consensus in that you may want to ask or even charge the big groups out there in terms of maybe a work group to get together between now and 09 to kind of lay out some parameters to see if legislation, dollars, what kind of items are necessary to kind of take this forward to the 09 session. And this might be something that perhaps the Institute and AHEC might want to share together in terms of maybe a work group approach with all the different players involved. I myself could be involved in terms of the kind of a liaison between yourselves and that group as well. Just something for consideration.
Maybe we could crystallize this in the form of a letter from the committee to the Institute and AHEC with a request that they collaborate and bring back to us the recommendations so we do have a solid database for all the healthcare professionals.
Yeah, I'd make that pretty prescriptive, too. I'd say I would ask them to develop a tool that can be part of a mandatory reporting system that the boards will use, and that's common tools, so it's common for every board. And have them develop that tool for us, and if possible, they've done a lot of work this already. This is not going to be groundbreaking, and report back to us by February 08 session. That's 2 months away, and
what their work plan would be.
Yeah, what the work plan would be, and certainly by 09 we should be able to put some legislation together as a committee bill, saying this is a new mandate for boards, and I think the boards would embrace it really. This is a mandate they're not looking. There's a mandate they'd love to have someone give them direction on. They're all on the same page. They're all using the same tool. The data comes back in a protected fashion, and they can relook at themselves and say, what's our workforce going to be in the future? It's not their responsibility to enhance that workforce. Well, the Board of Nursing has done a lot to do that, but it's their job to get gather the information, and as we were told, then it's the Institute and AHEC's job to analyze it and implement changes.
Okay. Are you in agreement with that?
Excuse me. Absolutely. Excuse me.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll do that. I'd be happy to participate where it would be helpful, but to at least have the preliminary work plan put together.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Well, I very much appreciate the patience of Dr. Rubin and Dr. Richardson as we've been discussing healthcare issues. If you would please come forward, and we look forward to your comments. By way of preface to this issue, there were quite a number of us that were disappointed that the ORMED program was not formalized in the sense of adopting and funding. But we did not want to let this issue lapse without expressing our interest in giving you the opportunity to come back and discuss how do we move this issue forward, because the discussions we've been having about workforce shortage and the need for physicians and coverage in this state, it's critical, and you are a major player in that solution. So we look forward to how do we get more physicians in the state of Oregon. How are we going to do that, and how can we help you?
Well, thank you, Chairman Morrison. Thank you, Senator Bates and Westland, for allowing us to update you on some additional information related to the workforce. I'm, of course, very interested in Barney Spate's work on the Health Fund Board and what's happening there. And I think there is an essential piece that we need to recognize, and that is the impact of physician shortages on any healthcare program that we develop for Oregon.
Excuse me, Dr. Richardson.
Yes, sir.
We need to have you identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Dr. Mark Richardson, Dean, School of Medicine, Oregon Health and Science University. Thank you. So what I hope to do is just go through a little bit of an overview about some of the factors which are driving those shortages, some forecasts, some trends related to some data that we've developed, and hopefully some potential solutions that we might utilize to help solve the problem. There really is not just overall a shortage of numbers. There is a shortage of numbers, but, of course, there's a significant maldistribution of physicians as it occurs not only in Oregon but throughout the country. As a result of that, we have the effects that you can see up here in this PowerPoint presentation. Most importantly, out of this particular slide, I think what we need to understand is that if we're going to have meaningful health care reform, we do require, or that requires, a robust and highly qualified physician workforce, and the concept of a medical home is based on providers. If we don't have enough, we will not be able to do that effectively. I want to mention also, it's not just numbers, but it's the education of those physicians to know outcomes, efficient use of technology, and information technology that is going to be critical to a successful resolution to our healthcare issues that face us today. How did we get here? Medical school graduation rates have remained relatively flat for the past 15 years. We are increasing those numbers at present, but it's been relatively flat. We do have an aging. Yes, Senator.
Okay. How do we get here? Flat med school graduation. How do we get there?
Maybe I could help that if I could.
Please.
About 15 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, there was a Nash report that told us that we were going to have an excess of physicians by the year 2001 or 2 or 3. The report was based on incredibly flawed data. I didn't take into account anything you're going to talk about in the next few minutes. Remember that the the time lapse for someone to become a physician is 14 to 15 years. You got to do your pre-med, which takes 3 to 4 years. You got to do your medical school, which takes 4 years. And then you got to do a residency of 3, sometimes as much as 7 or 8 years, depending if you go into a fellowship or one of the longer residencies. So your time gap here is huge. It's 15 years to turn out a physician that's trained the level that he's talking about. If you start out 15, 16, 17 years ago saying you have an excess of physicians and it's a federal policy to restrict the number of physicians because of that, so medical schools were told you're going to flatten yourself out, and residency programs, which are primarily funded by federal funds, and they start capping those residency programs, this is what you get.
Very well put, Senator Bates. There's one additional factor which contributed to this was we actually were dependent to a certain extent for about 15 to 20% of our workforce from European or other sources. We've had a change in entry to the U.S., and those people are now severely restricted in terms of entering our workforce.
So a constriction.
And some of them don't want to come. There was about 7 or 8 years ago, the entire medical school class of the University of Alberta, the entire graduating class was recruited to the United States. They lost every one of their people who was recruited to the United States. Those Canadian doctors came down here. With the climate now to practice as a physician in the United States, we are seeing Canadian physicians going back to Canada, and we're not having influx of Canadians that we used to.
That's correct. Additionally, as Senator Bates pointed out, we do have capped residency training opportunities so that the actual number of graduate medical education slots has been capped, I think, since 1995. There's one other factor here which is, I think, very important to recognize. With more gender equity in terms of the entry to medical school of women, we do have a significant amount, not strictly on that basis, but there is a significant amount of change in terms of lifestyle expectations and productivity. There's also, on the demand side, I think some significant drivers: a growing population, an aging population, an increased prevalence in our aging population of chronic illness, and again, a number of secondary drivers that relate to this as well. As the baby boomers age, there's some expectations about their health care and their access to it, which is expected. We do have some economic growth, I think, which is going to create some demand, as well as medical advances, which, of course, we want to see. Oregon is growing, and it's growing faster than the remaining area of the U.S. We're growing at about 1.9% per year versus the national average of 1%. We're aging at the same rate in that we're going by 2025, the 12.5% of Oregonians who are 65 or older will double. And as a result of that, we're looking at a demographic issue which shows that the healthcare system will be accessed to a greater degree by that elderly population. So if you look clearly from ages 75 and above, we have sort of a logarithmic increase.
A little fire drill?
Yeah, not a drill.
Now we have to vacate the Saturday.
Where we are supposed to go is the center exit and cross the street together.
Thank you.
Now we've had fresh air and we're all awake.
And with the committee's indulgence, I'll try and move quickly through these slides so that we can get to the end of the presentation and allow Dr. Rubin to speak as well. These prevalence intensive disease processes are quite common in the elderly, occupy and require lots of resources for management. I do want to point out that there are significant distributive issues related to physicians in the state. You can see that Multnomah County has approximately 4.5 physicians per thousand. but if you go over to Wheeler County, there are no physicians with relatively unequal distribution throughout the state. If you look overall, the U.S. ranks 13th in sort of world health statistics in terms of physicians per thousand, with an average rate of about 2.65. It's estimated, or I think our goal here is that we're trying to reach about 300 per 100,000 or 3 per 1,000 if we were to utilize at least world statistics in terms of overall health care delivery. Using the Oregon Employment Department, this is their data, trying to calculate the need. I think you all are aware of these numbers, but there's also a caveat that they delivered, that they felt that this was at least an underrepresented estimate, so that the actual gap between what we're producing and what we need is probably larger than this. There are several other things, I think, that are taking place here. The student debt load, the average debt load at graduation is about $155,000. Almost all of our students, despite an aggressive tuition and scholarship programs that we have, still have debt. And the pressure to pay off that debt does discourage Oregon practitioners, primarily related to lower reimbursements and, to a certain extent, some malpractice issues that exist in our state. Certainly a rural lifestyle may not meet new physician expectations depending upon their exposure to rural life in the past. The government is predicting a significant shortage, even at a baseline demand. That does not include the demographic data. If you include that and see that high use demand, you can see the significant gap that we have in practitioners. Currently, we have and graduate about 120 medical students per year. We have about 5,000 applications per year, 7% of which are from Oregon, and our current class is 70% Oregonian. We also have 200 physicians who complete their graduate medical education at OHSU, and a total of all graduate medical education slots in the state is at about 300 to 320. It's a little difficult for me to give you the exact numbers, but by polling all of the hospital systems, that's my best estimate. 52% of OHSU medical students actually end up staying in Oregon. That's much better than the national average. And 56% of our OHSU GME trainees stay in Oregon, and that's better than the nationwide average as well.
Excuse me, Dr. Richardson.
Yes, sir.
For the record, can you explain the difference between medical students and GME trainees?
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. Medical students obviously are completing their graduate education in medicine. The GME refers to beyond, once you're a physician, you go on to advanced graduate training in a specialty, whether that's family medicine, OBGYN, or orthopedic surgery. So that's the additional training that Senator Bates referenced.
Mr. Comber, real quickly, if I could.
Yes.
You always learn something new in these things. I never would have guessed that we'd have two fires in the same number. That 7% figure is amazing to me. Only 7% of the people who apply for the medical school are from Oregon.
That's correct.
That's a stunner.
It is.
I will hold this one for the record. I do not hold this.
I apologize for this, but we have to comply.
If you contrast that with those 12 countries that go in front of us, they have a higher percentage of physicians per thousand than we do.
So they're 13. We're 13th.
We're 13th. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we'll keep going here. This is sort of a historical perspective from the AMA. You'll notice these statistics are a little bit different than the ones I just gave you. This is because this is a 40-year profile, estimating that 45% of our graduates stay in Oregon. The prior page that you have is related to our own data that we have determined from finding our alumni and basically chasing them down, at least over the past 15 years. This is where we rank, just in terms of having the numbers of GME training slots per 100,000. And you can see that we're very similar to Washington in terms of that particular statistic. Idaho and Montana do not have medical schools, and obviously the number of training positions is lower there. Now, despite, I think, what is very good retention, our output simply is inadequate at this point to meet the demand that we need. We have polled all of the practicing physicians in Oregon. 32% of those did all or part of their training at OHSU. So we are a net importer of physicians and providers. And as I think the nationwide shortage worsens, we are going to be competing for those additional physicians to meet our demand. So this is the part I think that's the important aspect of this. How can we increase the supply? How do we improve the geographic distribution? And I think we can do that. We can use ORMED to help us with this. We want to create opportunities to stay in Oregon, leverage our resources, and enhance regional partnerships in the process. So I'm bringing to you three ideas at this point. A medical honors program. This is something that is not new to Oregon. We have had combined BA and MD degrees in a 7-year time period in our past, but I think it's something we need to revive. We already have regionalization and clerkships at other sites for our clinical years, the third and fourth years of medical school. We want to increase those numbers, and we want to have a consortia of graduate medical education training sites, whereby we use the state of Oregon as a statewide training process. Now, these are all still in the development phase, but let me just explain a little bit further about what we're trying to do. First of all, the medical honors program. 25% of U.S. medical schools offer combined undergrad and MD programs. The basic design is a 7-year curricula. We have an advanced fourth year undergraduate year, which counts as the first year of medical school. We do this accreditation through OHSU. We're going to hopefully develop partnerships with the University of Oregon, Oregon State, and Portland State, and of course we will give preferential Oregonian acceptance. By doing that, because our facilities are constrained in Portland, we could add approximately 30 new students to our university with this program. It's a shortened time frame, so we increase the output. There's less student debt as a result of this. I think it also helps create an interest among the undergraduate institutions that are involved to enhance their undergraduate pool and start feeding our pipeline earlier. And again, it leverages the existing resources which we have. We do need, as we increase our class size, to make sure that they have clinical opportunities for their third and fourth years. By doing so, we are introducing our students to other state providers in Bend, in Eugene, in Medford, to encourage future practices in those areas and enhance community partnerships. We do have sites, but we want to increase those, and some of the necessities relate to training physicians there to educate, as well as accredit those sites and housing for the students.
Excuse me, Dr. Richardson.
Yes, Senator
Your
Morris.
Reference to clerkships would be synonymous to clinical rotations?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And a GME consortia. 56% of OHSU GME trainees settle in Oregon. We need more training sites. I think that is clearly influential in the distributive issues that we have related to our physicians. By doing so, I think we can help those health centers in our communities. We can create exposure to rural settings, and we connect rural communities with potential future providers. I think under this particular program, what we would be doing is trying to help those regional centers by performing. Again, we do have a fair amount of experience related to accreditation and management of those training programs to help support our regional partners in graduate medical activities. There are precedents for this. In 1993, the legislature actually helped begin the Cascades East program in family medicine at Klamath Falls. They have anywhere from 6 to 8 trainees per year. It's a 3-year program, and it has 6 participating community clinics. Again, under this particular model, OHSU is the accrediting body. It provides administrative, curriculum, and faculty support. Because Sky Lakes has an independent federal cap to support the graduate medical education that takes place there, those costs can be recovered. We also have a rural surgery program that exists in Grants Pass. We know that the training for rural surgeons is different from those that are going to practice in urban centers. And so we have now established a rural rotation, which introduces those surgeons to rural practice and pairs a new surgeon with a regional surgeon in the area. Under this arrangement, again, we provide curriculum support. Asante actually pays the costs of the program. And already, people who are interested in rural surgery rotations are applying to OHSU to participate in that activity. So I think there are some real opportunities for us in the future to help solve the problems that we have. We do need more physicians. I think we all want to be part of the solution. We are going to involve as many communities and undergraduate institutions as we can to help solve the problem, and ORMED, I think, provides a great framework under which to do that.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's very informative. Dr. Rubin.
Yes, Senator Morris and Senator Bates, Senator Weston, thanks for inviting me here. I'm going to shorten this down a bit since we're running so late. I think you have my comments, my very comments you can really refer to. And you're already familiar with the concept of the ORMED program or medical honors program, which is basically regionalization of medical education, and I think most of you are already convinced of that it's worthwhile. I think what I'd like to do is take a few moments to sort of give you a notion of what things are like down at OSU, and as representative of how well situated I think that many of our campuses away from the OHSU campus are to participate in a regionalized program of medical education. I think most of you already are aware that OSU is a land-grant institution, right? And as such, we have always traditionally maintained faculty with multiple undergraduate and graduate curricula tightly linked to the health.
Excuse me, Dr. Green, I need to have you introduce yourself as well. This is all ministerial type
oh,
stuff.
I thought I had. My name is John Rubin. I'm chair of the zoning department.
He did it? Okay.
Yeah, that's all right. I'll say it again.
And he's good committee staff, Dr. Rubin.
Thank you. Thank you. That's all right. Again, OSU as a land-grant institution has traditionally maintained faculty and multiple undergraduate and graduate curricula tightly linked to the health sciences, long before any concept of ORME had to regionalize the medical education came up. Currently, about 1,500 of our 19,000-plus undergraduates at OSU major in pre-professional or pre-health programs like pre-med, pre-dent, pre-nursing, pre-farm, microbiology, and it goes on. Courses taken by OSU pre-professional and pre-health science students include instruction in human anatomy and physiology, and we already include extensive use of human cadavers in our laboratory instruction, human embryology, cell biology, microbiology, including study of infectious diseases and pharmacology. Not surprisingly, then, much of the specialized staffing required to present a quality first-year medical program is already in residence at OSU. They didn't come there for that reason. But it's serendipitous that many of them have medical training and could easily step in and perform valuable roles, especially in first-year medical instruction. Let's see. Right. I could go on with that a little bit more, but I think you get the notion. The curriculum would be presented annually at Cordley Hall, which is located on the Corvallis campus. And for a relatively modest investment of about $3 million, OSU can remodel Cordley so that it would provide space for up to 45 first-year medical students to study laboratory aspects of anatomy and physiology, as well as a modern 50 to 60 seat lecture hall, which would be appropriate for medical students. Modest capital investments would be required before we could deliver programs to students enrolled in the joint program. So if operating expenditures were to be included for the 2009-2010 biennium, the earliest the programs could be delivered at OSU would be the second year of the biennium, because it would take pretty much the first year to accomplish the capital investments and make the changes we need to make. We don't need to go back over that. I think I'll just conclude by saying OSU, UVO, PSU, and community-based healthcare systems, and those healthcare systems, of course, would focus on years 3 and 4 of medical education, can, with relatively little additional investment by Oregon taxpayers, readily step into the breach and begin to help alleviate a statewide physician shortage. There's a pathway the legislature can take to prevent a crisis. Moreover, the regionalized approach to medical education is likely to produce more physicians, and this is an important point, I think, interested in practicing in rural locations than is currently accomplished by a solely Portland-based medical education program. And I suspect strongly, I don't have data. For example, if we had a regionalized medical education program on campus at OSU, all right, we would attract more of our top students. We've talked to them in the last year and a half. They would be more interested, rather than going to Johns Hopkins or Stanford, and we have quality students to go off to those places. Their interest has definitely piqued the possibility of being able to be trained, for example, in Corvallis or in Bend or Eugene rather than Portland, and it seems to be would be an inducement for them to stay, especially if we were to institute what we're calling this medical honors program. That is where the fourth year of the undergraduate education is integrated with the first year of medical school, which is basically how we might run the program down at OSU. We would attract not only more of the top students, that we hit our top undergraduates to OHSU medical program. I think that it's likely that students who might be inclined to practice in rural areas would end up doing that if they spent most of their medical education time down in some of the regionalized areas rather than in Portland. Now, again, I can't give you figures for this. Our chief medical pre-med advisor has been talking to a lot of the students, and this is the impression that she's gained in the last year and a half or so. So we'd benefit not only in the quality of students, but I think it might help also, I don't have hard and fast figures for you, might help in directing students once they graduate in our positions to go into areas where maybe they don't want to so much now.
Well, we have Thank you very much for your comments. We have a work in progress, is what I sense is underway. And the goal would be, with this revised plan, would be to go from the 120 graduates per year to X.
Hopefully, under this plan, we'd have somewhere between 150 and 160.
So from 120 to 150 to 160. When will your plan be sufficiently crystallized, programmatically as well as capital requirements on the front end?
We're working on the capital requirements right now. Obviously, the capital requirements for each of our partners needs to be developed, and I think it would be I hate to put a timeline on that, but hopefully we're going to have figures by March or April that will be relatively firm around each of these components.
So the expectation of maybe asking for, I know this is quite possibly remote, but asking for capital appropriation, not programmatic appropriations, in February, it would not be timely to be doing that? Or what is your thoughts with respect to that?
There, you know, one of the things, I think it would be presumptuous of me to speak for all of the regional partners that we're trying to attract in this effort, but I think one of the things that would be exceptionally helpful, this effort, as you can see, and the involvement of so many different health centers throughout the state, our undergraduate institutions, is requiring a significant amount of time and effort on everybody's part. Some exploratory or some sort of monetary support to help us move this program along would be incredibly helpful to make it gel and to provide the details, I think, which you all want to see as we bring the program forward.
Do you have a sense of when we might see specific proposals?
I will generate that as quickly as possible, and certainly before the first of the year.
I asked my colleagues to comment. The ERMET plan, as I recall, and I would sit on the subcommittee that heard that testimony, in effect was creating the equivalent of nearly a new medical school in the capital request. Actually, it was a capital request, wasn't it? Or was it programmatic?
It was programmatic.
Programmatic.
$7.2 million.
Correct.
Dollars. It looked like a good buy.
It's a heck of a buy.
A great buy. I guess the question is, how do we bring this back to the forefront in a way that we can move it to a successful conclusion? And I would ask my colleagues as to, you know, what your thoughts might be in that regard. Our interest is not to let this lie. We want to move it forward. And the longer we wait, as you said, this timeline.
Senator Morris, if you permit me for a moment, we are at OSU because of our faculty staffing and things like that, and it's, we did a lot of planning for the ORMED program when it was being considered during the last biennium. We are remarkably close to being able to, if we had a facility, to whenever the money became available from the legislature to start the program. I mean, we can pull the trigger on relatively short notice. The limitation is the facility. You know, so if what you needed from us, as an example of what could happen at one of the regional campuses, whether it's U of O or PSU, if you wanted a detailed plan from us in terms of what the curriculum would look like, we could certainly work on that and integrate any response with OHSU fairly quickly, and could come up with a proposal for what kind of capital improvements we need in terms of building like the Corley Hall very quickly that you could use as sort of a, you know, bit of a, put it out there. Here's an example of how easy it would be to do it and how quickly we could do it, and what's the timing required on the part of the regional campuses to get going as soon as possible. So, I mean, you could certainly lean on us for that, if it's useful to you.
Mr. Chair, having just come from Ways and Means and a long discussion about the February 08 session, let's only have a little discussion here that may be some reality. First off, I think what you're trying to do is absolutely correct, and I'm fully in support of it. Don't anyone say that. And you're doing it in a cautious way, because what you haven't mentioned here is you want to maintain quality.
That's correct.
And it's important you maintain quality in this field, and you just can't jump into something like this and turn it out. So I appreciate that as sort of an underlying thing that I know is in your mind going along here. The opportunity to get a second bite at the apple from the last session and the 09 session, or the 08 session, is probably not a reality, okay? Unless you want to do things in a little different way. There's two ways you get money for an institution like this. One is you get a straight amount of money from the general fund. One is you get what we call 11G bonds, where there's match money involved. Or there's something called a COP, a certificate of participation, which is the state gives you a right to raise money on your own. It gives you a better interest rate, and the money is paid back with a guarantee by the state over a 15-year period of time, usually by the institution itself that is actually raising the money. So there's three or four different ways of going about this. The preferred way in most cases is 11G bonds. That's what we see most commonly done. And that would clearly require an 09 situation. I think what the chair is asking for, and I think it's the right thing, is a clear understanding of what your financial needs are to get this program going. I don't think we're too concerned about curriculum. That's your responsibility, not ours. We trust you to do the right thing. You have 5,000 applicants for 100 positions. You obviously have a program people want to get into. So I'm not worried about that part of it. But I think we need a clear, concise picture of what your actual financial needs are to make this happen, with no surprises later on, no cost overruns later on. And then we have to look at what are the financial mechanisms we can use to get that money to you, whether it's a COP or 11G bond or a straight amount of money from the general fund. All those are difficult. They're all political, but can be done. Entering into this also is a discussion we have not heard today, which I would ask you to think about also. In many states across the nation, private medical schools have come in to fill this gap because there is a need, and they've been successful. They've been most successful when they've formed a cooperative agreement with the public school that's also there, because I think there's needs for both of these, and the demand is so huge, there's plenty of room for both of them to work. And I think it would be helpful to what you're trying to do that if a private medical school talks about seriously coming into the state, that it's not a turf battle, it's a collaborative effort by both sides, because I'd be supportive of both those groups.
I'm glad you mentioned that. There is, I think, opportunity for private medical schools, but they are still going to be constrained by graduate medical education opportunities, and I think that is part of our thinking, that wherever those graduates come from, whether it's OHSU or another private school, they still need to be able to be trained in our state, or they have a high likelihood of leaving.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, and as you and I discussed a few moments ago, ORMED is a good step in answering that question. My community has about 500 hospital beds, and we've never had a training program because we didn't perceive, or some of us did, our general medical community didn't perceive a need for that. While Klamath Falls, 75 miles away, understood it 20 years ago and has a great program going through, and you were the ones that helped put that together. So I think there's potential for residency programs across the state that have never been tapped but need to be tapped. I'm glad Asante finally stepped up in Grants Pass. They can do it in other areas also. Having said those, the third part of this is having a climate in this state that is conducive to having physicians stay here. You can train them both in your medical school and your residency program, and if we don't fix some things in the state, tort, reimbursement for physicians, and some other issues, we'll keep losing them, and you know that as well as I do. But the first step is what you're trying to do, and I'm fully supportive of this. The question is, how fast can we get it done? And that's our job on our side here. You presented a great program. I'll fully support it.
Thank you.
Just before we go to Senator Westland, to kind of close the loop on the funding issue, we need a comprehensive concept that includes the programmatic as well as the capital, inclusive of all of the state institutions, Portland State, University of Oregon. What do they need to become involved and geared up? As a practical matter, February is a short time period and not likely to get funding started unless you had something ready to roll and we can start working on. It sounds to me like it's probably an interim.
That would be fair.
And I guess, you know, where this comes out of, I think, this last session, it did not come out of a policy committee. It went directly to Ways and Means, as I recall, the ORMED concept.
That's correct.
Would there be an advantage to have this come out of a policy committee by way of recommendation and then championing support for once it gets to the Ways and Means process? Senator Bates, what's your sense of that?
My sense is that you teed it up the last session. You're going to bring it back to us next time around. It should go through policy and then to Ways and Means of Understanding. It's on a dual track. We talk about both of them. And I'd like to see the governor on board with this as one of his initiatives also, because that's what made some of the other things happen before. I've seen money put into higher ed in certain areas. I dare not say where it went a few times, but I thought what's not as high a priority is human health. And there was no questions asked. And so I think this is something that needs to be done in a broader force. And I think that getting the governor involved, running through a policy on both sides of the building, and getting into Ways and Means fairly early in the session needs to happen. I think you've got a great concept, the shortening of the process, utilizing what we have in place already. Just who can argue with that? When the need is understood of how bad the shortage of positions is going to be in the state in the next 5 or 10 years, I think that should be able to put through.
Well, first of all, I know a committee you could get, interim committee, you could get a unanimous recommendation out of. Right, Alan? Right, Frank?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ready to make a motion?
But I have 2 points I want to make. First one's a question. What are typically, maybe it's an unfair question, but I'm reading your letter, Dr. Rubin. Mm-hmm. What are typically the, lab fees for a first-year medical student?
I'm not sure what the lab fees are. I think, Mark, the standard tuition is around 30,000?
Yes. Our standard tuition is about 30,000. The cost of that medical education is closer to somewhere between $75,000 and $80,000per year. And, of course, our state support is, I think the last figure I had was $23,900. So there's still a gap, but that's sort of the numbers as I recollect them.
Well, I'm just looking at Dr. Rubin's letter, and, 45 first-year medical students, I assume the facility could be used by second year. And
actually, no, the plan would be that the ORMED program is pretty much limited to the first year of medical education. I think at the moment, and Mark can speak to this, and like the intent is to have all of the students spend their second year in Portland, and then years 3 and 4 in one of these regionalized, say Pacific Care in Eugene or Good Samaritan in Hospital in Corvallis, something like that.
Where I was driving with that is a fourth option of funding.
Yep.
The some iteration of F bonds, and maybe get a special classification where we could get some tax exempt, and depending if you could increase the utilization of that building and the specific equipment in it. And I know tuitions are too high, and I know the students are graduating with too much debt, but some balance here where maybe it could be a fee-driven repayment schedule of the capital improvement.
Seriously.
So I don't want to say too much because that's kind of our university policy, but yes. And keep in mind, when we're talking about 4 OSU only, I mean, we're talking about a total amount of renovation equal to something under a little bit or around $3 million total,
right,
to get it going. We're not building a new building or $45 million. We're using basically what's there.
Well, and I'm trying to I appreciate that, and my little numbers would be about $2,500 a year, and you could totally, you know, service the debt service on $3 million. You extrapolate that to three or four, five or six other facilities around the state. Perhaps that's a different methodology for funding. But perhaps more importantly, what I'm concerned about is what we're all concerned about, is the timing of this thing. And certainly isn't there something that we can do now, February, you know, that at least turns this ball over one time. So when we get to 09, you know, we are further down, they are further down the road, and there's more, you know, capacity to perform sooner. That's what I'd like to look at. You know, what can we do, you know, sooner?
What you're saying is the program is constrained by the capital, front-end capital costs? Or
at OSU, program. It is, yes.
So if you can somehow get the capital appropriation to get things rolling, then the programmatic issue follows, and that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. U of O and Portland State University also are involved in this, and we've not heard from them. We need all three of them lined up at the same time, not just Corvallis. We've got to have them all three. We can't have bits and pieces flowing into this thing. And I think Senator Westland, he wants to get things rolling. I agree. As a minimum, I would expect you have a program locked in financially and presented to LFO for discussion in Ways and Means in February. And that would be the first step, at least. Whether you get the money in February, I can't tell you. If it was something not requiring general fund money, it would be a limitation. And you know what the state can do is not just give you money, but give you a mechanism that is very, very good for raising bonds. You know, tax-free bonds, and good faith state behind it allows you to sell those bonds at a very low rate. So the payback is pretty easy in comparison to go out in the private market. But to do that, you have to have a really good financial picture of what's going on, a really solid business plan, sell LFO on it, sell Ways and Means on it in February of 08, and potentially, I suppose, I've asked Ben and Frank what they think too, potentially you might get an okay on that. That could potentially happen as long as there's not general fund money involved. The foot in the hose is going to be on general fund monies. But I would think that the Ways and Means Committee might well look at a program that didn't have general fund money into it in a very positive fashion. And that's something, with that kind of money, I don't know what the other two universities need financially, but something that could be manageable.
Let me say this really clearly. He's a physician, so sometimes this doesn't come across.
That's a good way to start talking to a physician. That's very good, Ben.
Exactly.
You are smooth.
Get the four institutions involved here. Get together. Figure out exactly what is needed, and then I'll give you my number offline, and let's figure this out, because we're talking finance here, so, and we're talking capitalization. So that opens up. This isn't administrative. This isn't programmatic. This is capitalization.
Sure.
There are multiple ways to properly and prudently capitalize genuine sticks and bricks projects. So, because this needs to happen sooner than later.
So the admonition is sufficiently, the business plan is sufficiently developed to have the capital requirements, and let's find a way to get those in front of Ways and Means for February.
You know, I tell you,
with a specific financing plan.
Yeah.
Just not here, figure this out for us, no.
You got to have a specific plan and have LFO on board
Alpha has tremendous control of what the decisions are made are as far as ways we sell them on it. We've got a real opportunity to sell it to the Legislative Assembly. And if you sell it to Ways and Means first, they'll sell it to the rest of the Assembly for you. But you got to move pretty quick now.
We can do that.
But we've got to have those tools.
Okay.
I'd say by probably the first week of January, second week.
First week.
First week.
Hey, we're going into session in 30 days, and we got to build the coalitions and all that good stuff.
Okay. The LFO, and we got to talk to co-chairs. We got to talk to Ways and Means. Ways and Means will be meeting in January 4th or 5th, I think. Does anyone know the exact date we're meeting again? Ways and Means Subcommittee. Ways and Means Subcommittee. I think it's. I know it's the first week of January. I think it's later in that part of that week. Well, I'd be able to lay this on the table for them.
But I don't think we need to get holy water sprinkled on it by Ways and Means first week of January. We just got to be able to start to move the ball forward
like
February.
I don't think you have to have holy water then, but you have to have some idea that it's coming.
Right.
Okay. We want them to be understanding it's coming. It's been well thought out. Telephone knows about it. Starting the process.
I did visit with the Senate co-chair and advised him as to the process we were going through, and he welcomed the discussion.
Great. Thank you very much for listening.
No, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Well, I think we probably discussed this issue sufficiently today, and the encouragement is to see if we can refine the plan sufficiently to get some legs under it for a thoughtful discussion in February, and hopefully at least the front-end capitalization part of the plan.
Great.
In February. And you have three people here that are committed to moving that discussion forward.
Great. Thank you very much.
Can you hear the comments?
Well, we got great news for you. We won't charge you extra for two fire alarms. That's on the house.
Thank you very much for your patience today. We